Now, as a matter of further intelligence, a term used by the FBI, let me clarify the meaning of the expression, he is a liberal. The enemy, meaning the one-world conspirators, have seized upon that word liberal as a cover-up for their activities. It sounds so innocent and so humanitarian to be liberal. Well, make sure that the person who calls himself a liberal or is described as a liberal is not, in truth, the Illuminati.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, streaming live on Friday, the 21st of July, 2023, from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Yeah, you've got to have an app for everything these days, and even we, yes, amazingly, even we have got an app. Available free from all good app stores, anything please, but Google. And it's really useful at the end of the show and the evening after. You can listen to all the longer interviews on the app, and it will just remind you just before the show starts. So hi to anyone particularly tonight listening on the app. I think it's a great idea, although of course these phones that we download these apps on to are a curse. I'm Tony Gosling, and thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. Cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, or at least trying, whilst Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity are all forgotten. For the evil Putin is looming on the horizon. Goldman Sachs' Nazi-faced bunch of Bilderberg death trip losers, Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment drones, want us as slaves to their machines, and the wife-murdering king now waging open war on the British people as well as Putin. So, of course, they can't win that. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it hadn't been occupied by the Zionist lobby, if I'd have managed to continue my career. And you can understand why they might not want me saying things like this on national or even local radio. But it is interesting because I keep hearing people I work with on Radio 4 doing things like reading the news, things like that. Anyway, helping us navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, we're going to be looking at particularly at Scott Ritter, this amazing new piece he's done called Agent Zelensky, which looks at the people who are actually running and managing him. It also looks at his drug habit, that kind of stuff. And we'll be running through quite a lot of other items, having a look, for example, at the enormous amount of energy that our data centres are using. I've got a couple of clips with Robert Kennedy Jr. One is an interview with Piers Morgan, where he talks about how these accusations of being an anti-vaxxer. Of course, most of the media in the Western world is simply, what's it doing? It's just trying to ignore him. But of course, he is a major runner for the Democratic nomination, and so it'd be really interesting to see how he gets on. And also, both he and Naomi Wolf will feature in the end, in the last half hour, as we listen to both of their views on God. I was quite interested to hear that Robert Kennedy doesn't quite believe in God, but his idea is basically, if you act as if God is there, then God sort of turns up, which is like quite an interesting take. I don't know how exactly that can be. Maybe Martin can help us with how you frame that, how you describe someone that doesn't quite believe in God but acts as if they did exist. Martin, any thoughts on that one?
Well, it used to be called agnosticism, which was invented in the 19th century, wasn't it, I think?
Well, if you're agnostic, you didn't think it was important whether or not God does exist. And so,
well, the agnostic really means you don't know one way or the other, and exactly. Therefore you're on the fence on it.
He's definitely not on the fence, although, because he's saying he lives his life as if God did exist, even though he doesn't quite. Anyway, we'll get to that when we come to it in a couple of hours. But let's start off with I've got a couple of pieces about sort of eco subjects. I'm talking to you, by the way, from down near Tavistock in Devon, which is rather, the weather here this week has been rather nice. And this story I've been looking at this week is about the cloud uses massive amounts of energy. Generative AI will be way worse. And this is from Business Insider. A Microsoft data center veteran warns big changes are coming. So training AI models in data centers uses up to three times more energy than traditional cloud tasks. Also, most existing data centers don't have the infrastructure to handle this new surge in demand. The next generation of data centers will be a major drain on resources. So last year, Data Center Alley, I'm not sure, oh, it's part of Northern Virginia, apparently, funnily enough, quite near the National Security Agency. Isn't that strange? This area of Northern Virginia is home to more data centers than anywhere else in the U.S., and the local utility Dominion Energy has warned it might not be able to meet surging demand. This has happened before a ChatGPT-inspired AI boom that is set to double or triple the amount of energy consumed by new types of data centers. What's coming will probably make the Dominion Energy debacle look like a walk in the park, according to industry executives, researchers, and analysts. Major cloud providers, including Amazon, Microsoft, Google, are racing to meet demand for this generative AI, and access to electricity could become even more important than clever new model designs or computing heft. What's clear is today's data centers are not built to support this new era of technology. And it goes on to talk to one of the chief executives of Digital Bridge. Also, Martin, what we're seeing in this fascinating little article in Business Insider is that there's now also there's also now protests going on outside these new data centers. One of the Microsoft data center veterans has been part of this protest. Tom Keane, who oversaw Microsoft's cloud data centers for about two decades, warned about this. He said Microsoft's the main backer of OpenAI, the creator of ChatGPT, and builder of the most powerful AI models around. He said in the case of training data center, you make that as big as possible. You put as many computers in there as possible, and you're running that data center at full utilization all of the time. That's what he told Bernstein analyst Mark Merdler in a recent interview. That physical data center starts to become more resource intensive. You start to design it very differently. Starting to actually turn up with these people with massive stop signs, Martin, on their campaigning shirts saying stop these things. So it does seem as if maybe the technology is kind of way ahead of what these electricity networks in the United States can actually provide.
Well, it's quite interesting because back in the day when the internet was first developed, there was somebody I was at university with whose name I've forgotten, but he was at Balliol, and he wrote a book called The Weightless Economy. And it was about how we were going to move as a result of information technology to much less resource intensive service based economy. He was a New Labourite. So that was the kind of line he was taking. You know, all those dirty industries are going to disappear and we're all going to become programmers and coders and so on. But of course, the reality of the weightless economy is that computers, especially when they're used in this kind of configuration, are incredibly resource hungry. Bit like electric cars, but more so. So the idea that you're going to resolve ecological problems by using IT is rather put in question by this, isn't it? And it's a big issue all over the world. I mean, if you remember some while ago, the police busted what they thought was a cannabis farm in the West Midlands. And what it was a Bitcoin mining factory. So the whole cryptocurrency thing is dependent upon huge amounts of electricity. And of course, the thing about cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, gold does have some uses. You know, you can make rings out of it and jewellery, and you can buy things with it if people accept it. It's got some uses in electronics, but Bitcoin has got no other use other than as Bitcoin. So is it a useful economic product or not?
Martin, I'm trying to make clear for listeners this. I mean, most people probably know this, but Bitcoin mining is a kind of pointless exercise, isn't it? The idea is that you can create money out of nothing by just using loads and loads and loads of electricity and loads of processing power to do a pointless, basically a long-term pointless task, which eventually you end up with a Bitcoin, a new one.
Yes, and of course, it can be done. They've demonstrated that it can be done. But, of course, it's got the same problems as any other kind of artificial currency. It can be a speculative thing and it just goes bust and so on. You know, you're better off putting your cash under the mattress.
I wonder, much of this, you know, this is not the first time, not the first time this has happened at all, is it? The idea that this is a kind of great vision for the future, with computers doing all sorts of things for us, you know, chained to the computer for the rest of your life, that kind of thing. With the computers just, and you just having a kind of nice leisure life, like Yuval Noah Harari's vision. The only trouble is, I mean, in the United States, last winter, they had several serious long, you know, quite long term, over a day and that sort of thing. Blackouts. They don't have enough electricity now.
Well, that's right. So, but and therefore, this is not necessarily a solution. I mean, if you've got all your eggs in one basket like that, where everybody's totally dependent on a system which can crash, then you've got to, you know, it could crash at a crucial moment, you know, just as you're about to invade Russia or whatever. So, you know, there are lots of modern systems are like that, aren't they? They're very complex and very interrelated. And of course, you can then get catastrophic cascade effects, can't you?
The customers would raise their eyebrows and have a wry smile, I'm sure, if that happened. But anyway, look, we're going to have a listen now to Mihal Tusi. He's somebody that I've seen quite a lot of on YouTube. He's one of these people that does quite a lot of these. Very popular, well listened to. He's obviously raking it in from the YouTube monetization quite well. And therefore, of course, you know, maybe he's saying this stuff just for the sake of it. But he does have facts to back up and reports that he quotes to back up what he's saying here. Mihal Tusi, that is, talking about electric cars. Now, he's done some number crunching, and others have done some number crunching, looking at these electric cars and just how much CO2 emissions it costs to create the batteries for these cars, and also, of course, other things to do, not just with the batteries, but obviously the electricity that they're being charged up with too. And what he's decided, and he will explain very briefly, we'll hear 4 minutes or so now, of him explaining how actually electric cars should be exposed because they don't reduce CO2 emissions at all.
Electric cars are failing. And not just the way it happened in Scotland with Police Scotland, where they changed all the cars to electric cars and they forgot to have a charging station, so the cars stopped working. But they're also not working when it comes to net zero. That was the whole idea, wasn't it? Clean and green energy. Greta Thunberg's utopia. Yeah, that's not really what the evidence is currently showing. Yes, the electric cars are not reducing emissions, especially the way that people thought that they could. Obviously, that was never going to happen, mostly because everything that you need to build the electric cars, including all the materials around the car, you're going to have to build it, which means you're going to have to use other energy sources, which means it's never going to be net zero. It's never going to be like that. So the emissions are not going to be reduced that much anyway. And so we have this situation where while electric vehicles do not produce tailpipe emissions, okay, yeah, we know that, the materials that must be mined, processed, and refined to build the cars produce considerably more carbon dioxide than those used in to build the gas-powered counterpart. Absolutely embarrassing. Again, it's nothing new, but this is a new report, and the Manhattan Institute decided to publish this and focus on this, but actually like respond to it. So we have Mark Mills, who argued that substantially offset the whole thing offsets reductions from avoiding gasoline. Yes, we know that, but it could actually even lead to a net increase in emissions because of everything else that you need to build the parts for these cars. Now, some forecasts, reports, cites, for example, assume that the minerals used to build electric cars come from North America, where power grids are much cleaner. In reality, Mills says that China refines 50 to 90% of the world's suits of energy minerals, and the emissions associated with Chinese refineries are considerably higher than those seen in the United States or Europe. As a result, Mills calculated scenarios in which driving an electric vehicle leads to greater lifetime emissions than driving a gas-powered car. He said, if implemented, the internal combustion engine bans will lead to draconian constraints on freedoms and unprecedented impediments to affordable and convenient driving, the report said. And he said, and it will have little to no impact on global carbon emissions. In fact, the bans and the electric vehicle mandates are more likely to cause a net increase in emissions. I would love to have one of these eco-activists to come on the show to have a debate with me. And I keep trying to invite them. They keep running away from debate. This is not really anything new when it comes to the political left and the far left ideologues completely being scared and terrified of any sensible political debate on all these issues. This is just about facts. This is about your own science. These are just rational arguments. If they can defend the current program for electric cars and the current program to ban the existing cars and push for these sort of things, well, if you have a good argument, come on the show and we'll have a good chat. Now, I'm in favor of everything. Diversify your portfolio in life. I would like to have all energy sources, but no mandates, no increase in taxations, no subsidies. If you want to have your solar panel, have your solar panel. If you want to have your gas and extract your gas, do that. Nuclear, definitely. That's what you do in a normal civilized world. But we don't live in a normal civilized world anymore because the nutters have taken over our authorities and our establishments. And we're just sitting here on the outside saying, where are the sensible people?
So that's Maya Tusi talking about electric cars. He's exposed for not reducing CO2 emissions. Is it possible, Martin? We're being sold this whole net zero CO2 emissions business, but is it feasible that maybe actually electric cars might burn just as much CO2 or use much, just as much CO2, emit just as much CO2 as other cars?
Yes, it's quite possible. I can certainly understand why that might be the case. And of course, what we're really talking about here is corporate greenery, where it says, well, we've got to have cars, so we've got to have electric cars. Whereas you might just say, well, what we need is publicly owned railways, which people use for free. And we could also, for example, subsidise the reduction of energy use, which Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute pointed out in the 1970s. The solution to a lot of what we're doing isn't new technology of any kind. It's just making our existing technology more efficient, which we actually know how to do, but we never get round to it. Just like after the 1973 oil price rise, everybody was saying, well, we're going to reduce the size of cars and make them more fuel efficient. The Japanese were developing exactly those kind of cars, and the Americans just said, no, we want our gas guzzlers, and they've still got them. And, of course, there was no reason to keep your gas guzzlers. You could have decided at that point we're going to reduce our footprint. And then we don't have to even argue about whether it's climate change is an issue or not. We should be doing that anyway. But that would require having a plan, which is what your right-wing friend there wasn't really talking about. No subsidies. Well, that puts nuclear power out then. Nuclear power only exists because of subsidy. Without it, it wouldn't exist. So there is no free market in energy. When we're fighting over who's going to have a pipeline and the pipeline get blown up, that isn't a free market competition. That's the Americans blowing up the Russian pipeline to wreck the German economy so that they can follow their geopolitical goals. And this is what a lot of this debate doesn't take into account. We could all work together to solve economic and ecological problems around the planet, but unfortunately we can't because we're at war and you don't do deals with people you're trying to kill.
Yeah, well, I mean, Martin, you make these rather irritating stabs at people for being right-wing or left.
He's against subsidy, Tony. I believe in subsidy. I'm a socialist. He's against all subsidy, but he's incoherent because he's against subsidy, but he's in favour of nuclear power.
Let me finish my sentence, please. Would you mind letting me finish my sentence? Shall I start again?
Go on.
Right. You make these digs about people being right-wing or whatever. Actually, what's going on here is surely nothing to do with the free market. It's about massive subsidies for a particular type of thing, which most people think is a left-wing thing.
Yes, but he is saying he's identified himself as a right-winger. He's saying left-wingers are in favour of electric cars. Guess what, Tony? I'm a left-winger. I'm not in favour of electric cars. I'm in favour of maglev railways. I'm in favour of bringing in massive you've got to retrofit everything to make it more efficient, and you've got to have a plan. The market will not do it, and the market would never do it.
It's that there is a plan.
It's the wrong plan, isn't it? For the reasons we just said, it's the wrong plan. It's a plan made by the corporate bosses in the West, and it suits their interests. Yeah. That doesn't mean you can't do without a plan. We just need a different one.
We're absolutely right. I totally agree. And I think it's fascinating the way that much of this has come through control of government, which is now stuck in this debt trap. But anyway, I mean, there are obviously major problems with the climate. And I'd just like to, you know, for the record, regularly say on this show that climate change definitely is going on. But I came across a clip recently with a former professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Richard Lindzen, from MIT. He's now retired, but before he retired, and maybe this is a little bit out of date, he had some fascinating things to say about the general idea of climate change. So what we're saying here is that the climate is changing, but possibly the actual reaction to it and the plan that's been drawn up by God knows who in order to sort climate change out is rather like COVID and the vaccines. So, yes, COVID is happening, but the plan with the vaccines, particularly here in the Western world, was way over the top, and particularly things like injecting children who had really no chance whatsoever of dying of COVID. These sorts of things were completely OTT, and maybe there's a similarity going on with the climate. So let's have a listen now to Richard Lindzen from Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Is the temperature increasing or decreasing? It's always doing one or the other. I have no concern about that. By asking people to worry about whether it's going up or down, you're immediately establishing dishonesty. The Earth is always changing. Climate change is nothing you have to prove. It always is happening. It always has happened. So to make that into something alarming seems to me a little bit weird. Sea level is a hard thing to measure, actually. At any given place, traditionally, sea level was measured by what are called tide gauges, a stick in the water, basically. And two things change what a tide gauge shows: the land moving up and down, and the sea moving up and down. Most places, it's the land that is the biggest effect. So you don't have a good measure of sea level rise. On the other hand, for the last 30 years or so, we've had satellite measurements that are actually measuring sea level. It's very hard to relate these two measurements to each other. They are measuring different things. The general feeling is there is no evidence that it's different now than it has been for the last few thousand years. It's been slowly rising ever since the initial rapid rise after the deglaciation 12,000 years ago. The claim that we've suddenly seen a big change in that, given we've changed the instrumentation and given the error bars cover the difference, is not entirely fair. And to suggest that what's been going on for thousands of years is something we should suddenly be alarmed at also doesn't seem reasonable. When you hear a Ban Ki-moon saying life as we know it will cease if we don't do something, what is he referring to? I don't know. I mean, man is adaptable. People retire to the Sun Belt, not to the Northwest Territory of Canada. Although catastrophes certainly occur, they have many causes, of which global warming is one of the least. There are so many interesting questions in climate. We still do not have a complete handle on why we had ice ages. Now, you know, if you want to be concerned, you want a disaster, having 2 miles of ice on your head is problematic. And the Earth has had that. It's very much a matter of the unchallengeable assertion. All religions have dogmas. Dogmas are not proven statements or assertions that cannot be challenged. It doesn't mean they're false. I mean, I'm not even suggesting that. I'm simply suggesting that it's a bad idea to have anything that can't be challenged. And the trouble is, all of us scientists are government employees. Even if we're working for private universities, all research is supported by the government So as such, we're very sensitive to what politicians say and believe. Well, that's a shortcoming. You have to figure out how to fund science in a way that there are no incentives to artificially promoting things. You know, when you hear, for instance, a scientist saying the science is settled, you know that person has stepped out of the science. So, you know, I think that registers with ordinary people. And whenever you see someone say, you know, instead of answering arguments, how could so many people agree if it weren't true? It should be a red flag. My view is one has conflated the trivial, which is that temperature is changing, climate is changing, man plays some role. There's not much disagreement with predictions of disaster that are not connected clearly to warming or to our activities or to anything else, and leaving people with the thought that if the first part is true, the second part must be true. That is certainly not the case. And then to add insult to injury, to propose policies that would have nothing to do with any of it, but involve trillions of dollars and harm to many people, is, I think, crossing the line.
Well, the dulcet tones of Richard Lindzen there. And I suppose, Martin, maybe, I mean, there's lots he's just packing in there. I mean, you've got these enormous non-man-made climate change, quite obviously, going on over history. But he's also making, for me, the most important point is this whole idea of science and universities, touching on the idea of, depending on who funds a particular university department these days, it's almost all private industry, very little government funding anymore for the research. In fact, what's happened is a gravy train has been created.
Well, I think that's possibly true. I mean, you've got to distinguish whether a climate change is happening, whether it's caused by carbon dioxide emissions, and then there's a big question, what do you do about it, even if you've all decided that that's what is happening? So, I just think that a lot of the climate change agenda pushed by the West, and I'm not saying that there isn't climate change. It looks to me, for example, if you've got the Arctic, there's loads and loads of interest in getting into the Arctic from a geopolitical point of view, because loads of resources are in there, and the Russians and the Chinese are developing icebreakers so that they can bring goods to Europe from Asia across the Arctic. Now, that's only possible if there is climate change. So, and that could, whether it's caused by global, but you know, by the sun or whatever. So we've got all of these issues in there. And then there's a question of what would you do about it, even if we all accept that it's happening. And of course, the West is pushing its solution, which is we're going to bring in technologies to deal with all of this, and we are going to, and you're all going to fund it. And of course, the developing world is saying, well, yes, but you've got to help us. I mean, there's been loads of droughts and things that they're common in the developing world, as we know. And, if you really wanted to help the developing world to resolve the problems, you've got to forgive them their debts. And the other thing you've got to do is you've got to make peace with Russia and China. But you're not prepared to do any of that. So in actual fact, you're not serious about global warming at all, are you? Because that's the only serious things you could do.
I mean, it's one thing which has been, I mean, on this show, we've had David Douglas with two S's speaking fairly regularly over the last year or so about the technology which is out there for coal, to use coal-fired power stations, which is almost 100% of the CO2 is captured on the emissions. Now, this was a process invented in Britain, developed, ready to roll out, where they were going to take the CO2 and store it under the North Sea in some of the old gas fields under the ground, under the seabed. And just as the whole thing was ready to go into production, the government pulled the plug. So this is nothing to do with, it seems to me the policy's got nothing to do with zero carbon emissions and lowering carbon emissions, because if it did, they would go ahead with these things. What it's got seems to be is strategic energy around the world. Now, what we had, for example, in Britain up until World War II was coal was a major – and then we started getting oil. This was the deal done – maybe you can remind me. It was Abdulaziz, wasn't it? And was it Roosevelt? Roosevelt.
Yeah, but the switch to oil from coal was
the Bitter Lake deal, wasn't it? That was done with the Americans and the Saudis, and that set the tone for the post-war massive oil boom, didn't it?
Yeah, well, you can go back further than that to Churchill's decision before the First World War to switch British ships from coal to oil, which then led to us having a very serious interest in Iran, which ultimately led to the overthrow of the Shah, the Iranian Revolution, and all the rest of it. Well, this
so what was flavour of the month, right?
Well, it wasn't just flavour of the month, it was what World War II was run on.
Flavour of the century, maybe. What about, I mean, it does make me wonder when I look at these big strategic energy policy changes and the cover stories that they're sold to the public with. Looking at there is a potential, as you and I say regularly on this programme, for a major world war, particularly with the tensions in the Middle East, the US-China tensions, all these things, the Russia-US tensions, the Russia-Europe tensions, they do seem to be heading towards some sort of major. And, of course, in a major conflagration like that, the oil tankers are never going to be able to make it across the ocean without being blasted to kingdom come. So perhaps this is a part of this is an admission that actually we cannot be reliant on oil if we want to fight a world war.
Well, I think the control of energy is clearly a vital strategic goal of people who've got, the geopolitical players, the big ones that are fighting each other. Once if we can get a resolution to the geopolitical tensions, then we can have a sensible discussion about things that need to be done. But if we can't do that, and as I said earlier, the only way to get the developing countries on side with this is you've got to forgive them all their debts, which means complete restructuring of the Western banking system, and it means that the wealthy classes in the West have got to be dispossessed. Now, they're pushing this green agenda, and you have to say, well, the green agenda, Prince Charles, means you've got to lose all your wealth, really. And if you're not prepared to lose all of it or most of it, then we're not serious about doing anything about this, are we?
No. Martin, I think you and I are absolutely at one on this whole idea of, well, look, it's like peeling back the onion to try and find out what's going on. And we try and do that here. But one of the things that, I mean, we had in the 1960s and 70s, Martin, and I can remember, I'm sure, if you made a film, a documentary about just about anything, you could just start off, you would either get it shown in cinemas or you get it shown on TV. We're just welcoming all sorts of films, anything that they made. So that was what you called the golden age of television. They were, pretty much anybody that wanted to write a play could get it produced and put on somewhere. TV was very accessible, open doors. It almost you could walk in and say, hey, I've got an idea, and get it somehow shown, because this was the way that television got into people's homes, because it was great. It was good stuff. And also, of course, the advertisers wanted good thing people to be watching it so they could put their things on. We're now in the similar thing with the internet, but it may be being closed down all over the Western world. There are new bits of legislation coming in, like the online safety bill. And I spotted a fascinating little talk by a lady called Amy Peacock, and she works for the online platform, which has in many ways replaced YouTube for the more interesting content that YouTube will remove. BitChute will not, so this is a good place to go. I've got my own BitChute channel. And Amy Peacock has, I think, some fascinating things to say about this UK online safety bill, particularly to do with the getting rid of all of encrypted chat. So the idea that you can have, the encrypted chat companies may have access to it. We're not entirely sure about that. Maybe the NSA do. But the fact is, in the future, it will be perfectly legal for the government and these companies to read what you're saying to each other and maybe to sell it on. And actually, some of the companies like Signal, not heard so much from Facebook, but the online chat app, They're very annoyed. They're saying, no, we don't want to do this. We're not going to be forced to do it. We don't, and they're campaigning against the online safety bill. But anyway, this is, I thought, an excellent briefing. This is a part of it, and I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from BitChute's Amy Peacock on the online safety bill.
You have Ofcom, in consultation with the Secretary of State, having discretion to revisit whether certain things should be exempted from regulation under the bill or not. So on my reading of this, what I think the, you know, CEO of Signal was concerned about in that clip that you've probably seen go viral around the internet, if you're in those circles where you're concerned about this, what she was concerned about was the fact that the bill could be amended or modified just by Ofcom and the Secretary of State to no longer exclude the messages on Signal, and that potentially, because of the terms of the bill, Ofcom could mandate proactive scanning of every single bit of content on a regulated service. So, you know, obviously certain things would have to happen in order for encryption to be broken under this legislation. And as you may have seen on that clip, you know, with Kathy Newman, where Meredith was up against a former member of parliament, as I understand it, that was who the gentleman was. He was defending the legislation and saying, oh, they would never do that, you know, and by the terms of the legislation right now, it seems to exclude doing anything to encrypted messages. But her reading of it and my reading of it tends to agree that Ofcom and the Secretary of State could work together to revise it and no longer exclude, you know, not just those categories, but there was educational content and other sorts of categories of website that would have been excluded under the bill. Maybe they won't be excluded if Ofcom and the Secretary of State so determine at a later date. And I think that's what she was concerned about. So I think it's a real danger.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people who are very concerned. What Amy's referring to there is an interview that took place recently, I believe it was on Channel 4. Now, there's a BBC article, Apple joins opposition to encrypted message app scanning. So Apple has criticized powers in the online safety bill that could be used to force encrypted messaging tools like iMessage, WhatsApp, and Signal. I suppose that would also include Telegram. To scan messages for child abuse material. Its intervention comes as 80 organizations and tech experts have written to Technology Minister Chloe Smith urging a rethink on the powers. Apple told the BBC the bill should be amended to protect encryption. The government says companies must prevent child abuse on their platforms. End-to-end encryption. Well, this is my reading on this. Maybe I'm coming from a very cynical place. I mean, there's no one in their right mind who would be against stamping out child abuse content on any platform. And that's right. Where I sort of it sets up an alarm bell of, you know, the oldest tactic, I suppose, to achieve government overreach is, you know, won't somebody please think of the children? Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, is there... do you see in the wording of it, in the potential overreach, do you see it as just simply misguided? Do you think this bill is coming from a good place, or do you think that there is something genuinely nefarious about it? Or am I just being paranoid?
Well, you know, and I've been trying to figure these people out, and it was funny. I had an exchange with someone yesterday where I'm saying, you know, is it the case that the powers that be actually believe that they can change human minds by means of technology, right? So if they can just get the online platforms to curate content, moderate content, whatever you want to call it, a certain way, plus maybe tweak the algorithms a certain way, perhaps all the hate in the world would just disappear, right? That they maybe actually think that the technology can do this. And of course, they have seen algorithmic manipulation of users of online platforms. And so are they thinking that they want to just turn this to good and that somehow they're going to achieve their utopia or something? Maybe. but we could speculate all day about their motivations. What I really like to focus on is what is the actual language of the bill and how could it be used to affect both, you know, the conducting of business for a company like BitChute and the privacy and the free expression rights of the users of not only BitChute, but any online platform.
Yeah, so that's Amy Peacock chatting with you. Did you recognize the voice, anyone? That's at Computing Forever, isn't it? Chatting to Amy Peacock at BitChute about the UK Online Safety Bill. The idea here, Martin, I guess, is to get everybody absolutely hooked and addicted to chit-chatting to all their friends on an encrypted chat system like WhatsApp or whatever, with the understanding, right or otherwise, that it is all encrypted. And then suddenly the government presses a button. This is the minister or Ofcom, and it doesn't go through the Houses of Parliament. There's no debate or anything, but a statutory instrument is issued, and suddenly all of our stuff is being constantly monitored in real time by GCHQ and the National Security Agency or anybody else.
Well, it already is. Didn't that what Edward Snowden told us?
But is it illegal now?
And that, well, I mean, it's not been legal, but they've done it anyway. And nobody's been able to stop them. Obviously, we had Kevin Cahill on here last week because he's got that legal case that they've taken through to the European Court of Human Rights, where it's quite clear that the NSA has broken the law in the European Union. But nothing's going to happen about it. And in any case, if you think you're using an encrypted chat that you are not going to be watched or found out by somebody, you're a fool. You're better off to go into a corner of a pub with a very loud disco and chat to your friend like that with your phone switched off or maybe with no phone at all. That's the only way you're going to get out of this.
Yeah, I don't think there's any point in switching your phone off, actually.
No, that's right. You've got no phone at all, like the Taliban. Talk to people.
Because
there's no electricity anyway.
Friends of mine have got phone-free zones. They just say, well, go out and put your phone in the car or we'll go for a walk.
Yeah, but they can use your television. They can use your smart meter. You really, the only people who are outside the electronic cage are that the Taliban clearly obviously did work outside the electronic cage. And that's one of the reasons why they were able to win.
Reasonable here, because just simply by going for a walk maybe in the woods have got bugs in the trees, I don't know. But just leaving all your phones in the car when you go for a walk is
the answer, there is no real answer, actually. I mean, if you are engaged in some kind of nefarious activity, you'll have to take whatever steps you need to take.
Talking here about nefarious anything. I'm just talking about private matters that you may not wish to be on some, you know, database of your profile somewhere. When you go for your walk, you're not wondering whether work is going to call you and ask you a whole load of questions. You're just thinking, well, leave the phone in the car, leave it behind somewhere, and
I'm in favour of that anyway. You give yourself a break from it all.
With no electronic devices around at all. I just think this is a very sensible now. I mean, there are people that behave like that in a kind of paranoid, obsessive way.
Yeah, I think
way.
The problem with but that I is that everybody getting paranoid. I mean, let me just tell you a little anecdote. A few years ago now, some students from the university at the Student Union, they got some funding for activism. You know, they were getting students involved in activist activities. I don't know where they got the money from. Anyway, I went to the meeting about it, which is just round the corner from here, and they spent the whole of the meeting talking about the encrypted chat that we're going to have to set up so that nobody would know what they were doing. And all they're talking about is organising a conference about being an activist in the student union. And they were so paranoid about being listened to that they spent most of their time talking about that rather than what they were going to talk about when they got to the conference. And I just thought, this is silly. You know, I mean, you can't get away from the electronic cage unless you're up a mountain in Afghanistan. And even then, it's not 100%.
Yeah. But actually, no, if you leave all your electronic devices in the car and you go for a walk without them, you're pretty... don't make it easy for the other side, is what I suppose I'm saying. Anyway,
I don't think it's worth bothering with. You might as well just accept they're listening.
Shout down
the stethoscope.
If you're talking about really personal stuff, you might not wish to, you know, particularly about, you know, stuff to do with people's personal psychology or whatever. Why do you want that on the, you know, I say, you know, in that sort of situation, leave stuff at home. Don't give them everything. Martin, the consequences of all this, though, is that we've got this increasing kind of surveillance society, a government that's getting far more authoritarian all the time. And in the meantime, you've got a much, much more divided society. And there's a couple of people got things to say about that. I'll leave it up to you to decide who we hear from first. We've got Mick Lynch or Carol Vorderman.
Oh, well, let's go with Carol.
Okay, so Carol Vorderman here is almost like a kind of little roulette table here for Martin. I'm sure he loves it. It's she's been very outspoken recently about how much more is being taken from the poor to give to the rich. And I think it's, you know, what she's saying is government fraud and waste, particularly during COVID and since COVID, is absolutely, and this, of course, is all under the stewardship of the great Rishi Sunak, the lady who, or the man whose wife helped develop this system in India to try and get rid of cash. Of course, you know, that's one of the ways he's made all his money. The boy from Goldman Sachs. And so let's have a listen to Carol Vorderman now, to her take on how the poor are giving to the rich.
I started voting in 1979. I'm 62 years of age, and I've seen politicians come and go, obviously, during all of those years. I grew up in the 70s when there were the miners' strikes. I did my homework, you know, on the three-day working week where we only had electricity for 3 days and had to do it by candlelight. All of those things, I've lived through all of that, so I understand all of that. But never, ever in my lifetime have I seen what is patently a corrupt government like this one, where they are taking from the poor and they are giving to the already rich. Factually, we have seen yesterday there was the Public Accounts Committee put out, and nobody's reported it in mainstream media, that in the 2 years preceding Johnson becoming Prime Minister, there was an approximation of £5.5 billion of fraud and waste on government departments. In the following 2 years, when Sunak was Chancellor, that quadrupled to £21 billion of fraud, and it's not being investigated. And this report said, not that mainstream media has reported any of it at all, people wouldn't even know it existed, because they leaked it out on the day Prince Harry was in court, again using the bad news day tactic. So they said that the HMRC is a department for concern. They said that of the £7.9 billion that went into COVID testing, £6 billion of that was given to the companies recommended by Tory MPs and ministers and peers. You know, it goes on and on and on, and it's not being reported. I see that because I go digging for it. And then on social media, I put it out to my followers. And they see it for what it is. I mean, I could go on for hours about the corruption. Well, I'm very happy to. But, you know, Greg Hands, the current chairman of the Conservative, the last one had to go because he'd been dodging tax and then he lied about it, Zahawi. This one, not reported in mainstream media at all. This one, £25.8 million contract he gave to his friend, his personal friend, who was a chair of Hammersmith and Fulham Conservatives. His name is Mark Higton. He had set up a company called Lux Lifestyle, which hadn't traded at all. Suddenly, they get a £25.8 million contract for PPE. Oh, that's nice. He then sets up three other companies, Lux Care, Lux Care Consortium 2, Lux Care Consortium 3. So you've got four companies. Not one of those companies has filed company accounts yet for that period of time, and he is consistently trying to strike off the companies. And HMRC, I believe it's HMRC, I don't know that for a fact, are saying, no, we can't, refusal to strike, that's what it's called. And it's all there on Companies House, you can go and see it, everyone else can go and see it. So why isn't Greg Hands asking his mate, what's happened to the money? Where's the money? These are questions that people should be asking. You know, back in the 70s or 80s, people would have to resign automatically just for the discovery of that. And now we crack on as though nothing's happened. Well, it has happened, and it's affecting people. It's affecting people whose bills are going through the roof, who can bet, you know, for the food banks. We know all about this. And it's disgusting. I've never known anything like it in my lifetime, which makes me become very active. You know, I've been involved on the sidelines of politics working for both the major parties at various points to do with education and children, because that's my passion. The one understanding in life that I have is that the super rich never have enough. I have never known greed like they have.
Well, it's a lovely Carol Vorderman there. This reminds me very much of Kevin Cahill, who we had on the show last week, Martin, in the 1980s. He was a kind of, not exactly a jobbing reporter, but he was working with the Rich List team, but he was filing copy to the Sunday Times as well during that period. And I remember him telling me about, I think it was 1986 or so, he filed a story about the rich, and he went through some of the wealthiest people in the country, only to find that actually they were paying no tax at all. So his headline that he managed to get, and someone somewhere may dig this out one of these days, is on the front page of the Sunday Times, was the five words, "The rich pay no tax." So we are in a kind of topsy-turvy world, aren't we? It's quite nice to hear Carol Vorderman expressing it. And maybe that's why one of the reasons that she's no longer seen on television.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I agree with everything she's saying there. The civil service at the time of the COVID contracts crisis, as it were, they were, but the way the government of the day justified it, you know, this government, was that because it was an emergency, they needed to make decisions quickly, and therefore they created a fast track for people, because loads of people obviously applied to be the suppliers. You know, there was like supposedly an open process, but it said because there's so many people applying, we'll have to have a fast track, a political track, and therefore that's how all these people got on the gravy train. Now, the obvious thing you could have done is have the test and trace, for example, run by the NHS itself and by the local authorities, where you actually got people in place who are already trained to do it, but they chose not to do that. So we got NHS test and trace run by Dido Harding. And of course, the COVID inquiry is going to look into all of these things, but it's not going to report before the election. Although everybody who's been paying attention should realise how many people are on the take here. And of course, if we were to listen to their rhetoric, all of those people that are on the take, including the mates of Tory ministers, should be in prison and bankrupted, shouldn't they?
Well, I think they should, yes.
Yeah. It's not going to happen, though, is it, Tony? Do you think Keir Starmer's going to send them all to prison?
No, of course not. And probably something similar would have happened if Starmer was in with people close to him.
No, it wouldn't necessarily have been the same way. The Tories have got a particular culture of graft.
Of course, the Labour Party are just as, under Starmer, would be just as corrupt.
They'd be corrupt in a different way, Tony. You can't say they're all the same misses the point.
You're just trying to make a party political point, which isn't actually a party. I mean, for example, with this guy Mike, who was one of my in-law's neighbours in Stroud, he was reported in the Daily Mail as someone who got one of these PPE contracts. He had a company which was actually not making any money at all, suddenly got a PPE contract early in 2020, made an absolute fortune from this company. By the way, he was the master of one of the Masonic lodges. He was the only person in Stroud that I knew of at all, apart from people who were farmers living outside the town, who had a big sign on his front door saying vote Tory or vote Conservative. And nobody in Stroud votes Conservative. Well, it's not that kind of town. And it was him that won these contracts.
Yeah, so
the Tory corrupt our Tories. By the beginning of 2021, there was a big for sale sign outside his house. He's now bought a farm.
Yeah, well, the point is that the Labour Party, there probably is corruption in the Labour Party, there's corruption in all parties, but it would have been a bit different. This was a massive gravy train for those who were in the know, the people who had contacts with Tory ministers. Now, they justified it by saying, well, I have to have a fast track because it's an emergency, but the civil service actually kicked back on that and said, no, the fact that we've got to assess all of these applications from your mates, many of them are unsuitable, and it actually takes up time when we could have been assessing all these other people who might have done the contract. And in any case, a Labour government, I would hope, would simply have kept the whole thing in-house. The NHS and the local authorities would have run it all. And, of course, that's what should have happened.
Frost on, you do know that Jeremy Corbyn is no longer the leader of the Labour Party, don't you?
Yes, he's that beardy one, isn't he? Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, he has the beard.
might well have done that, keep it in-house. But I'm afraid Starmer is not that kind of
Well,
chap.
No, I'm just saying that there will be a difference, but it won't be as big a difference as people would like. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to hear from Mick Lynch now. And we've had over the last few weeks, I think, a fascinating litany. In fact, we've even had, haven't we, the Daily Telegraph this week publishing the apology from Coutts. Bank acts Farage as he doesn't align with our values. Coutts have excited the former UKIP leader over his comments on Brexit. Exited, rather, not excited. Trump and trans debate. So his views on Brexit, Trump and the trans debate are why Coutts actually have admitted that the... and, of course, you know, Farage is calling it a Stasi-style surveillance report. And it is, you know, that kind of thing. So the banks, obviously, the banksters, the satanic banks, as I always mention at the end nowadays, are the real problem here. And Mick Lynch is making it absolutely clear that he is not having this ticket office closure plan from central government. The idea is that these are all, it's going to be all electronic. You're going to do it on your phone and you're not going to speak to anybody. So let's have a listen now to good old Mick Lynch, who seems to be one of the people who should be running the country, possibly, in my mind, the main opposition figure in the UK right now. And maybe the only real opposition is the unions. Mick Lynch talking actually on GB News, Martin's favourite channel, talking to them about how killing cash could be a really bad thing because GB News have got a Don't Kill Cash campaign.
It's not just about ticket office closures. It's about the de-staffing of our railway, and the ticket office closure is a ruse for that. The way it works in this country is we have regulated ticket office opening hours, and that tells us how many ticket office staff should be there. What they're going to do in this campaign, which we're resisting, obviously, and we hope disabled groups, passenger access groups, women's groups, and all sorts of people who are interested will join our campaign to respond to this consultation. They're hoping to get rid of all these regulations, and that means there will be no laws or barriers to them de-staffing all stations. Any station in the country can then be de-staffed, and they will do that. We've seen the documents today. That means that most stations will have no staff in attendance whatsoever. So that means if an elderly person or a person with disabilities or a person with visibility issues needs to buy a ticket, that will be a problem. But then navigating their way around the system, you know, across onto platforms, onto the train, they could be without assistance. And indeed, what they want these people to rely on, Patrick, is that they'll then use an app to get... It's rather than having a friendly member of staff who's competent and knows what they're doing, they'll have to ring up a call centre or use an app. And if somebody's available, given the amount of job cuts they're putting through, they may get assistance if there's somebody in the area on a van or riding on a train themselves. So we are looking at compulsory redundancies of station staff right across the piece. We've been served with statutory redundancy notices today by most of the companies, and they are cutting more than 1,000 jobs that we believe out of the system. And that is an attack on what kind of railway we want. What we want is a friendly, secure environment where people can know if your granny wants to go on a train, they can get assistance, you can leave them there, they can get on with it. If your child needs to travel on a train on their own, that they can get friendly staff that they know are properly identified. Yeah. And what we'll end up is with a mugger's paradise. The people will know that stations are not staffed are the muggers, the drug dealers, the antisocial, the people that want to take drugs or take drinks in our stations, because there'll be nobody there with the secure environment. Now, this is dehumanising the railway.
It is.
And it's exactly what we've been campaigning against. We were told we were scaremongering, and now it's revealed they are going to close every single ticket office on our network, and that will mean mass de-staffing and a very dehuman railway going forward.
That's the leader of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, one of the successors to Bob Crowe, if you remember him. Also brilliant and articulate. Martin, why is it that our rail unions seem to be so articulate and say what's really going on? I mean, what he's saying there is what the government has just completely apparently ignored, and who are really running this dispute, as you know. And maybe we can talk about why in a minute. But the idea of turning this into some sort of electronic system with no human beings involved This is an idea. There's some sort of an ideology behind this. You know, this sort of computerization, artificial intelligence, God knows what. They probably would much prefer to have no drivers of those trains, that the trains were being driven by computer too. But the fact is, this is has a horrific effect on all the most vulnerable in society, whether it's the elderly, children, the disabled. They're all the people who are going to be kicked in the teeth by these ticket office closures, aren't they?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is the bottom line for the privatised rail companies. So it's not so much ideology as part from the fact that they're just trying to make as much money as possible and break the unions and the power of the unions. Although I've noticed today that London Underground staff who were about to go on strike have decided not to, because the Transport for London has come up with some serious proposals, including on things like closing ticket offices. Yeah, I mean, Mick Lynch's point there about railway stations have always been attractive to people who are homeless, for example, taking drugs. You know, and as he says, muggers will know exactly if there's nobody there, then they can get that. You know, this is where they need to go. And I think what will happen if they do ever bring it in is that's exactly what will happen. But by that stage, the shareholders in the privatised railways will have sold their shares and disappeared. You know, I mean, we should never have privatised it in the first place. I'm sure Mick Lynch agrees with that. And it's very hard to get people, especially a younger generation that have grown up under Thatcherism, which is what it is, that what it used to be like, and why we shouldn't, you know, the things that were important that we didn't need to change. If it ain't, what about the old conservative slogan? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well. Many of these train operating companies are based abroad, almost of them, in fact. This is the people that own the train operating companies. I mean, as we've been discussed this over the last year or so, on and off, you know, you've got your rail, it's not called Railtrack anymore, it's Network Rail that actually owns and controls the track. Then you've got these Roscoes, which are the rolling stock companies that seem to be the most profitable, even though they don't actually do anything for their money. They just sit there and rent out railway carriages and locomotives and things. And that's where much of the profit is. But the front end facing the passengers are these train operating companies. And just looking at, for example, at First Great Western, Great Western Railways, this is owned by some massive company, Martin, in the States, which has got an enormous amount of debt. And so their main object is to service their debt.
Well, that's right. And of course, you know, these thing, you know, things like railway are fundamental infrastructure. We were talking about doing things about, you know, carbon emissions earlier. One obvious thing to do is to have free public transport. But you can't have free public transport if you're doing it for a profit. It's what in the economics textbooks is called positive externalities. So you subsidise free public transport and you get all these positive outcomes, but you can't do it in the private sector.
What's the point of having a train operating company? I mean, how does it? Do we get into the situation in the first place that the business is sold from one business to another, and the business it's been sold to, it's got massive debts.
This is what's happened with Thames Water, isn't it? I mean, This is the problem with free market capitalism, is it goes bust. And then what are you going to do?
To run this infrastructure into the ground.
Well, that's exactly what's happened. And, of course, it's a way of making money for the fire sector, which is finance, insurance and real estate. And the whole of the policy has been dominated by these kind of people for years. After the banking crash of 2008, these people should have been sent to prison, their assets should have been impounded, and we should have set off on a different course, but we didn't. And of course, they get away with it because there's not no competition, but the real competition is now emerging. It's the nationalised Russian arms industry and the nationalised Chinese banking system, and they can't compete with it.
Various people have pointed out, to do with Nigel Farage's account being closed, that mainstream press, the London media, just simply poo-pooed it because it was Farage and they don't like Farage. So there is a bit of a danger of this, isn't it? The idea that you can have your bank account closed for your political views. There's a whole tranche of the press that that will just go along with it and say, oh, ha ha, it's Farage, who cares about him? But you know what? There is a sort of Pastor Niemöller, first they came for the communists side to this, isn't there?
Well, there is, although don't forget that Coutts is a private bank, and in actual fact, it's virtually impossible to get an account with them unless you're on an insider. And
Martin, can you go to the point that I'm making about somebody of a high profile, a political figure, having their bank account switched off?
Right.
This is quite clearly been targeted at Farage. People
yes.
like you were probably...
No, I wasn't poo-pooing it.
Cheer! Your first reaction is to cheer. Hurrah, Farage.
No.
Got a punch in the face. Great. But then you think to yourself, hang on, if they can do it to him, who are they going to do it to next? Maybe next week it will be Jeremy Corbyn.
The point I'm trying to make, Tony, is this. Coutts have got a problem because it's now come out, there's internal documents come out this week that they actually lied about the reason. They said it was because he didn't have enough money, and it turns out people inside Coutts in the management didn't like Farage, which is why they closed his account. Now, the point I'd make is this, for free marketeers like Rishi Sunak and the Conservative Party, Coutts Bank can do business with whoever they like. They don't have to, it's a bad publicity for them now, because many of their people who put the money in there are in fact kind of, you know, quite right-wing wealthy billionaires. So the fact that they're being discriminated, Farage is being discriminated against, means that they might take their money out of Coutts. So yeah, the stuff I was reading earlier is it's a bit of big PR disaster for them. But they're still within their rights under existing rules to refuse service to anybody. Like people can in a pub. I'm not serving Farage in my pub.
It's just a bit of kite flying by Coutts to see, and it may be, you know, obviously other banks have been doing the same, shutting down Palestinian campaigns to see what they can get away with, because obviously...
Well, they can get away with it, because they did, didn't they?
They've all been bailed out, and now they're seeing if they can flex their muscles and get involved in politics by cancelling people of a political view that they don't agree.
Well, I take the point that the banking system was bailed out, therefore they should have been nationalised, and therefore we could have some rules about not closing people's bank accounts. But as long as they remain private, and Coutts is very, very private, they're within their rights to cancel anybody's accounts, because they can just do that. You can't just join clubs in London. You say, I want to join Whites, you say, we don't want you.
You're spreading disinformation here. I wouldn't use the word lie, but it is absolutely a contract between you and a bank. And if they want to cancel that contract, they can't just flick a switch and cancel it. They've got to come up with a reason to do it. And yes, they have. So you don't, what you're saying is, oh, they can just turn you off any time. No, they can't. And they're not allowed to. Well, they can.
They can.
But what I'm saying.
And if he can see him in court, if they've broken the law, he could take him to court, but they haven't broken the law, have they?
If you have access to legal aid, or if you can use the cash that the bank has given you because it's closed your account to pay a barrister, then you could take them to court and quite possibly win.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see if Farage does that, although the Tory government seems to be getting onto this case about... I welcome, let's have some honest rules about what banks can and can't do. In actual fact, since Coutts have probably gone down the drain in 2008 as well, if the banking system in general hadn't been bailed out, let's nationalise the whole lot and have some proper rules about it. What about it?
Yeah, it's owned by NatWest, so it definitely was bailed out.
Well, there you are.
So we need to... I mean, surely this is really... What it is kind of what you were hinting at there, which is it's a call for... It should be, anyway, a call for banks to be nationalised and taken into the control of the Treasury.
Well, they have been nationalised, but they're still controlled by private shareholders, just like the railways companies, which were nationalised during COVID, but then the shareholders were all paid off. It's the way the system works. Now, I don't think Farage should have his account closed. I wouldn't close his account if I was at Coutts, but it's not my call. And Farage is a believer in the free market. Coutts don't like his views. He'll have to go and find another bank, won't he? Too bad.
Well, yeah, but it isn't just too bad. No, because
Farage's point of view, because he's very much in favour of the free market, does he believe in nationalising the banks? No, he doesn't. He believes that Coutts should be private, and therefore if they privately don't want to do business with him, he's got nothing to say about it.
I don't think you can make these assumptions, because there are lots of people who do believe in free market economics and free market capitalism, but they are now inclining towards the idea that the banks need to be brought to heel.
And, yeah, is that Farage? Does he believe in bank nationalisation?
Whether that means nationalisation or whether it means taking away banks' licences that don't behave themselves, this is a. I mean, there's actually quite a lot, probably more people on the right than the left that talk about such things, in fact, even though you would think it would be the other way around. There is most definitely on the right, there is a whole bunch of people that don't just see money as a god, and that whoever's in charge of it must be god themselves, you know, like that is to say the banks. They're not. They're actually in charge of what they believe in is they believe in small government, but they also believe in tough regulation in certain areas. So, you know, there are a whole spread on the right.
There's a whole spread of opinions. Of course there is. Especially and including on the right, but Farage, I don't believe, is in one of those that category that you're talking about. He was the one who said that Kwasi Kwarteng's budget was the best budget ever. So he's very much in favour of lowering taxes on wealthy people and not having the banks nationalised.
There are all sorts of things. I mean, I rather like Farage because he's outspoken. And particularly says things that people don't want to hear. And this whole idea that you've got to say a certain thing, I find it really darn boring listening to the BBC where they have programs on week after week where, you know, there's all this kind of political correctness, virtue signaling, and he will say things. It's a bit like the discussion we were having at the start of the show about science and about how, you know, that science is contested. Politics is contested. The right is contested. The left is it's all contested. The idea that the science is settled, it's like saying the politics is settled, isn't it?
Well, that's right, and that's why we're discussing it. But, I mean, I don't have to like Farage, I'm afraid, even if you do. No, there we are.
Of course, I don't. Well, what I'm trying, I suppose, to crowbar you into the position is to recognise that if it could happen to Farage, the same sort of thing can happen Jeremy, for example.
Well, we know it happened to the Palestinian charities who were closed down by NatWest, or was it HSBC, wasn't it? And nothing happened. They were able to do it. It caused all sorts of suffering inside Palestine, undoubtedly. And the government of the day, the Tory government, was perfectly happy with it. And now, if we're going to have rules, they've got to be rules for everybody. And that includes Palestinian charities and Farage. But at the moment, the rules are, if you're a private bank, you can do what you want. And we need to change that. We need to nationalise them. Ask Farage whether he agrees with that.
Well, I mean, what we're finding, actually, is, well, yes, you can do what you want. But, you know, you may well be taken to court. You may well lose.
Well, we'll see, because the government itself is talking about legislation on this.
In a way, Martin, what we're talking about, if you just take it a step back from this for a moment, and maybe we could agree on this whole idea that what's going on is a kind of lawlessness which has been brought about by Ken Clark and his taking away of legal aid. So if someone had their bank account closed in the old days, they didn't have much money, they could just go down to the law centre, which, by the way, the Avon and Bristol Law Centre in Bristol, I was walking past it the other day. Do you know what it is now?
No.
A pile of bricks.
Oh, yes, I have noticed that pile of bricks. That was them, was it?
At the bottom of Stokes Croft, where the legal aid centre used to be, where people could go and get free legal advice on just about anything and actually get free legal representation if they were claiming benefits or if they were on a low income. Now, Ken Clark got rid of all of that just after the Conservative Party won in 2010 in the coalition government, and the Liberal Democrats went along with it. Which is getting rid of legal aid. So this is one of the major reasons why the banks, it seems to me, are able to feel, look, well, we feel able to just shut anyone's account because we know that they're not going to have redress to the courts to come back at us.
Well, they know that we can engage in all sorts of fraudulent activity and nobody will be punished. It's called control fraud. They get the people in charge, are able to ramp up their own bonuses and all the rest of it, take risks that they're not supposed to be taking, and they get away with it. Nobody was sent to prison as a result of the 2008 crash, apart from Bernie Maddox or whatever his name was. In the 1980s, even when the Reagan administration was in power in the US, 1,000 top executives in the savings and loan industry, which was looted in a similar fashion, were sent to prison. The Pecora Commission in the 1930s, which Roosevelt set up, sent thousands of bankers to prison. None of that happened. And, of course, if you're not sent to prison, then you get more and more greedy, don't you, because you know you can get away with it.
Over 2008, there was a banker sent to prison, wasn't there? And he was actually a whistleblower, amazingly.
That's right, the guy who grassed up the stuff about LIBOR, yeah.
Rain Man. They called him, his nickname was Rain Man. And he'd been working for UBS and some of the big London banks, and he was actually trying to blow the whistle. And they said, you know, you're going to be the one who has to be jailed for this. And his father got in touch with me, who used to be a producer for or a journalist on World in Action. And we did a little interview with him at the time. So, you know, there were one or two people punished for the 2008, but they were nothing to do with the actual criminals themselves. Anyway, we're going to be talking about Scott Ritter, Ukraine, and much more after the break.
Beloved, the scripture moveth us in sundry places to acknowledge and confess our manifold sins and wickedness, and that we should not dissemble nor cloak them before the face of Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, but confess them with an humble, lowly, penitent, and obedient heart, to the end that you may obtain forgiveness of the same by his infinite goodness and mercy. Wherefore I pray and beseech you, as many as are here present, to accompany me with a pure heart and humble voice unto the throne of the heavenly grace, saying after me,
Shepherd, shepherd, where have you lost your sheep? Shepherd, shepherd, oh, where have you lost your sheep? Shepherd, shepherd, where have you lost your sheep? Shepherd, shepherd, oh, where have you lost your sheep? Think the sheep are gone astray. Yes, they've gone astray. Sheep are gone. Yes, they must have gone astray. Sheep are gone astray. Yes, they've gone astray. Sheep are gone. Yes, they must have gone astray. Shepherd, shepherd, where have you lost your lamb? Shepherd, shepherd, oh, where have you lost your lambs? Shepherd, shepherd, where have you lost your lambs? Shepherd, shepherd, oh, where have you lost your lambs? We think the lambs have gone astray. Yes, they've gone astray. Lambs have gone. Yes, they must have gone astray. Lambs have gone astray. Yes, they've gone astray. Lambs have gone.
So that's, well, it seems like a long, long time ago that pop music was being churned out like that. All we get now is it called Radiohead? I was listening to something from them last night. An absolute diabolical bilge, I think, is probably the kindest way to describe it. But anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, speaking to you from Devon. In the corner of a field, in near Tavistock, in fact, just on the west side of Dartmoor. It's just amazing how the technology does seem to be holding up so far, incredibly enough. So what we just heard there was, we started with Did You Pray Today, which was 1992 from Lisa Taylor, and we had a little bit of the Calendar Male Voice Choir, recorded in 2006, the most recent of the songs. The Shepherd is just the nice, simple title of that one. And finally, sorry, 1991 from C.C. Peniston. So, yeah, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, the Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I'm going to start this week, and I'm struggling to get organised enough to find the right time to tell you these. Patrizia did a poem about Keir Starmer last week, so we'll start with her in the second half with her very balanced other view of Rishi Sunak. Rishi, little bundle, a plunderer on the run, eyes wild and staring while promises are spun. To do the WEF's bidding, a mission to complete, no conscience for the people who have no cash to eat. His bank account is bulging, his head is in the cloud, while living out his high life, sews pockets in his shroud. On his little pulpit, looking like a clown, empty black eyes staring, no soul there can be found. He thinks he's made the big time, says he's not the hoi polloi. Schmoozer, sad sap Rishi, his image like a boy. Hidden heels are rumoured to be hidden in his shoes. He wants to be accepted. His middle name is Schmooze. His MO to destroy everything he sees, the cherry on the cake, the UK, to its knees. So many people homeless, cash is running short. Inversion and perversion our country now imports. Strings tied on his wrists for protection, he believes. With impunity now acting, no consequence conceives. Sovereignty for sale. The baton is in flames. Our country is on fire in the hands of the insane. Sunak, a little puppet, WEF needs now watch him so. A man so weak and feeble, a schmoozer for the show. Thanks ever so much, Patrizia. Another lovely poem. Keep them coming, love. Fantastic. And so, Martin, I think we better start with the rather more serious piece of news this week. I'm reading in the Telegraph, which is about the German coup plotters who were due to meet Russian diplomats before they were arrested. Prince Heinrich and the businessmen were allegedly trying to replace Germany's government with a pro-Russian monarchy. Well, I wouldn't be so sure about that. They might necessarily have been incredibly pro-Russian, but I mean, you couldn't get more anti-Russian than Germany is now, allowing them to cut off all their gas supply, the Americans to cut off all their gas supplies, and not saying a word about it from the Russians. So what do you make of this coup plot?
Well, I mean, I was always very dubious about the whole thing. It's likely a deep state manipulation. There is a danger from the far right in Germany, but it's not these people, and it's not and the plot itself seems extremely, you know, it's a way of trying to shepherd mainstream German opinion in a certain direction. There's a threat from these people from the far right, and of course the little twist that you've just mentioned, that apparently they wanted to talk to the Russian ambassador. Oh my God, you know, you can see what this is all about, really. It's an attempt to the level of manipulation going on now is extremely high.
What's your view? I mean, these people are all on trial now, so maybe they were part of a ruse, but maybe there were many of them, even Heinrich VIII, Prince Royce, one of them, who actually thought that they were trying to create a much more sensible foreign policy for the German people. in doing this. Of course, you know, there are much, I believe, anyway, of this global elite is led by wealthy aristocrats, King Charles being the most obvious, but there are literally hundreds of others, Karl von Habsburg, another one. But there are, there's likely to be people with wealth of some sort, whether it's business or land, you know, whether they're kind of aristocratic gentry, that do actually give us stuff and look at this and think this is insane. We're going to actually use our money and use our power to do something about it. Thank you very much.
I think more likely here is that these people are cranks who probably spoke out of turn in private, and they're being made an example of so that they the West can be carried on, you know, beaten down the road to disaster in the Ukraine. I think the whole story is extremely fishy.
To crack your nut here, because look, I mean, there must be some patriotic Germans that think that this is insane, and they can see that what's happening here is the United States is trying to drive Germany into a war with Russia, and they're not having it.
I think there are patriotic Germans who think like that. Alternative for Deutschland, and also Sarah Wagenknecht from the left, and Gerhard Schröder, who used to be the Chancellor of Germany, they are the real opposition to what's going on. These people are marginal. You know, they're not major players of any kind.
But it's not quite what you were saying, is it? Look, I mean, the idea here is you seem to be putting across that no wealthy German would think like that.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I think these people are probably innocent and that the whole thing is a setup by NATO intelligence services. I was talking the other night with a Hungarian guy in the pub, and we were talking about the Prime Minister of Hungary, Orbán, and one of his political party was an MEP in Brussels. He was caught having, sex with underage boys, I think it was. It was raided. And, of course, they're very anti-gay and all the rest of it. So it was big... big embarrassment for Orbán, but of course, underlying all of this is an attempt to get everybody into line to fight the Russians. Now, yes, there may be people in Germany who are, but what this is doing is saying that everybody who opposes German policy is a Nazi, and we're going to put these Nazis on trial, and that's a way of intimidating everybody to shut up about talking any sensible way about this. They should probably be released. The whole thing's a come on.
Okay, so maybe that will turn out to, because this what happened. This was last year, in fact, or the beginning of this year. I'm not sure exactly when it took place. But anyway, this is the trial of that these people who were arrested at the time. The meeting never took place because actually, it's three of them were among 25 people arrested the day before across 11 German states over the coup plot. Many of the 25 were members of the Reichsbürger, spelled R-E-I-C-H-S. B-U-E-R-G-E-R, or Citizens of the German Empire Movement. This is all happened December the 8th last year, all these arrests. Now, you and I know how they do these things, right, the intelligence services. Is what they do is they know there's going to be a backlash as the United States takes control of Germany and forces them through all sorts of nefarious means to start a war to the Americans' benefit against the Russians. And they know there's going to be a backlash against this. So what they do is they create these sorts of things. I mean, who knows? Maybe this Reichsbürger or the German Empire Movement are their creation. And the idea is it acts like a kind of a honeypot or whatever, so that anybody that has those sentiments is attracted to this controlled opposition.
Well, it may be controlled opposition, or it may be that in actual fact they've just been set up. We'd have to look into this in more detail, but I'm very, very suspicious of that. There was no danger of a coup. It's absurd.
What I'm saying is the same thing. Controlled opposition is a setup. The idea is, look, you know, here, in fact, the British MI5 and Victor Rothschild did this very, very successfully with this guy Andy Jack in World War II in Britain, is they set up MI5, legitimate MI5 Nazis in different parts of the country, particularly in the industrial areas, hoping and succeeding in attracting Nazi sympathisers to those specific individuals who were protected by MI5 in order to keep a very, very close eye on who was maybe a Nazi sympathiser or might, you know, start being a Nazi agent. And they managed very successfully MI5 through the, I think, wasn't it called the Fifth Column Network, in order to, I'm not sure how much you know about this, but yeah, it was the fifth column. They set up these various Nazi, pro-Nazi MI5 people in order to winkle out the real ones. And maybe that's what's happened here in Germany.
I think it's quite likely that these people have been honey trapped. They've been set up. As the FBI, for example, has set up hundreds of people to be terrorists in the United States. They create the plots. They then recruit the people. This is what happened in 1993 in the bombing of the World Trade Center. It was an FBI plot from start to finish. And then they recruited people to carry it out, and they allowed them to carry it out, killing several people, six people, and then they arrested them all. And that's quite likely what's happened here. I think these people have been set up. There was no real danger of a coup. The coup's already happened, if you like, and it's been carried out by the Americans. They're in charge of German policy.
Excellent point. What about this business in Poland? Because Putin is just today saying, don't even try anything, boys and girls. I mean, maybe this troop movement of 100,000 Russian soldiers is to counter this troop movement by the Poles.
Well, I mean, you said earlier when we were off air that there's a talk of 100,000 Russian troops in Belarus. I've been following things fairly closely, and I hadn't noticed that was the case. I know that there are Russian troops in Belarus. They've just activated their tactical nuclear weapons there.
Why don't you talk about what's going on in Poland whilst I dig out that quote?
Okay, well, in Poland, there's various loose talk going on about how we're going to have to go to war with Russia, and it's about time we all got ready to go to war. And they're going to build up. They're talking about they may try to overrun Kaliningrad. I think somebody was talking about that. So it was either Pole. Of course, this is absolutely insane. I mean, they've actually war gamed this out. And any fight between the Poles and the Russians are just going to win hands down. There's no way that they're going to win a fight with Russia, and it's idiotic to even think of it. But I'm afraid there's propaganda in the West. People in Britain are being cheerled along to support what's going on in the Ukraine, although they're getting a bit less enthusiastic now that we've had Wimbledon and the holidays, and, you know, they're worried about the fact that their granny's got cancer. But of course, in Poland and the Baltic states, there is a very nasty right-wing history there, where they're just anti-Russian because they just are. There's good reasons for it, but they're not very rational.
What we're hearing from RT is that Ukraine's military commanders sounded the alarm over a build-up of 100,000 Russian soldiers and a large number of tanks in the north. So this is in, I would imagine, we're not talking about Belarus here. We're talking, I think, about the east of, just east of Belarus, close to Kyiv. And so they've been doing reports on this on RT. We're not really seeing very much about it, but the Russians are certainly not denying 100,000 Russian soldiers and 900 tanks. I mean, do you think this maybe fits with what the Poles are up to or not?
No, well, I thought you were from what you were saying to me earlier, that they're in Belarus. If they're actually just behind the existing front line, then what's happening is that the Russians may be preparing to counterattack, which is what you do after the other side have thrown all their troops into a big meat grinder. Don't forget, they've only got a certain window of opportunity to do that, because once the Rapportitsa comes in the autumn, then you can't move heavy equipment around anyway.
Yeah. So the spring offensive, which was the time you'd expect a big offensive to take place, never happened. But anyway, we've had this attack on the Kerch Bridge, and almost at the same time, maybe you could say what you think about this, the Russians pulling out of the Black Sea grain deal.
Well, they pulled out of the grain deal for obvious reasons, which is that the deal was that they would allow Ukrainian grain to leave. And, of course, it was the Ukrainians who'd mine their own port. The Russians were quite happy for them to export stuff. They mined their own port, so nobody would insure people to go in there. And the deal eventually Erdogan set up. They can export their grain. It goes to Turkey. A lot of it actually ended up in Spain feeding pigs. It didn't, in fact, go to the developing world at all. And the Russians, of course, they are big suppliers of fertilizer and grain to the developing world. But they cannot export because their ships can't get insurance. And they said, it's okay, we will let the Ukrainians export their stuff. You've got to let us export our stuff. People in Africa are dependent on our stuff. Can't we export our stuff? And, of course, that's totally missing from the Western analysis of this at all, altogether.
That's right.
And because they wouldn't agree to doing that, the Russians said, OK, well, this deal's off then. We understood that we were going to be allowed to export our grain, and therefore everybody gets plenty of grain, Russian grain, they can all have their grain. No,
it's
we can't.
It's not so much we understood, but it was there in the agreement that the Ukrainians and the Turks signed. So there it should be allowed to happen. But no, it never was allowed to happen.
The agreement ran out on the 19th of July, and it could have been renewed if the West was prepared to do what they were supposed to say they were going to do, but they didn't do it.
The same day, there's an attack on the Kerch Bridge. What a coincidence.
Well, the attack on the Kerch Bridge is... It's possibly to do with the grain deal. It's also possible to do with the NATO summit. And, of course, the two parents who were killed and the 14-year-old girl who was wounded are the victims of this.
Martin, it seems obvious to me that it is absolutely to do with the grain deal, because the West knew that they were going to be pulling out because they hadn't fulfilled their side. That is to say, the West had not fulfilled their side in the grain deal. And so it's a sort of up yours to the Russians. So, you know, here's another chance for us to blow up your silly bridge, which we don't like in Crimea, which we like to sail British warships towards, because we still think Crimea is part of Ukraine.
Well, it looks like it was British submersibles, drones, which were involved in the attack. That's what the Russians are saying.
The Russians are saying that,
and I've even seen pictures of these submersibles. I can't remember what they call them. It begins with R. But it's actually British kit that's been used to blow the bridge up and kill those people. Those two civilians who were going on holiday with their 14-year-old daughter. They're dead.
In a way,
killed by the British.
When Putin built that bridge, he knew it was going to be vulnerable, didn't he?
Well, it was always going to be vulnerable to some extent, because it's the second longest bridge in the world, and they built it in double quick time. But of course, they're well able to defend it, because air attacks, they're going to shoot them down. It's actually a pretty sturdy piece of kit as well. You can blow it up, but you can there's been attacked twice now.
They have a pretty good system for getting it going pretty quickly afterwards.
That's right.
They?
Well, the last Almost attack, if you remember, there was a bomb in a truck from Armenia, and the guy who was driving the truck didn't even know he was carrying a bomb. So he died in the attack. Yeah. It was presented as a suicide bombing, but it wasn't, and then various other people died. I mean, if you were to attack the Severn Bridge, which, of course, the Russians may decide to do, since British kit was used to attack their bridge, then no doubt civilians would die. So that's why you don't do that stuff. Except you do, if you're that bothered. And, you know, I mean, that's what the Ukrainians have done.
What's the position with Crimea, though? Because the West is constantly saying, actually, Crimea is officially still part of Ukraine.
Well, that is clearly what the West is saying. But, of course, in actual fact, Crimea has been part of Russia since 1783. It's been part of Russia longer than Texas has been part of the United States. Texas invaded what is now Texas in the 1840s. And, of course, if the original Mexican border was still there, then all of these people crossing the Rio Grande, they wouldn't have to cross. They'd all be Mexicans. But, of course, the U.S., drove the Apache and all these people out of Texas and took it over. And that's exactly what the Russians did in 1783, which is why when Britain went to fight in the Crimean War in the 1850s, it was the Russian army that were fighting against, not the Ukrainian army, because Crimea was part of Russia, and it has been for a very long time. It's got an overwhelmingly Russian population, and they voted several times to leave the Ukraine.
But isn't this a sort of remake of the Crimean War, you know, the movie? Anyway, look, we're going to have a listen now to... the piece by Scott Ritter, which I noticed the other day, I was just watching, and it had only actually come out 20 minutes before I saw it. So it was, I mean, and I was really impressed with Scott Ritter's investigative powers. I mean, there are some doubts about Ritter, Martin, aren't there? About his apparently he's got some kind of leaning towards kids, and he was trying to groom one of them on the internet. At least that's apparently what the mainstream media.
He went
media
to prison for it, but I'm quite certain that that was a setup. He was flirting with somebody on the internet, and it turned out that they turned out to be a 15-year-old girl, but he didn't know that. But they got him, okay? He was foolish. That's what happened there. And of course, they will go after you. They'll find any way to get you. That's how they got him.
Yeah, so that's the reason why he's kept off the mainstream press, because apparently he's some sort of child molester.
Well, that's exactly why they did it, isn't it?
As Martin has just said, there are all sorts of doubts about whether that... was a setup. But anyway, Let's have a listen now, because this series is called Agent Zelensky, and it's pretty shocking stuff. This is just from part one. Maybe we'll do a clip from part two, which is already out. So one of the things I will do is put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk the audio of both part one and part two of Agent Zelensky by Scott Ritter, which we're going to hear a clip from now.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Ritter. Allow me to introduce myself for those who don't know me. I'm a former United States Marine Corps intelligence officer. I participated in Operation Desert Storm and served as the chief weapons inspector for the United Nations in Iraq. My main interests are international relations and armed conflicts in different parts of the world. I am convinced that we all should know a little more about a person who, to the applause of those I call the global elite, is ready to fight to the last Ukrainian, President Volodymyr Zelensky. Mr. President, there have been numerous publications about you, but everything seems to disappear from the web. Your image is carefully managed, and not without reason. You immediately understood why I named my film Agent Zelensky, didn't you? Let's begin. Zelensky portrayed the character Vasily Goluborodko, a school history teacher who becomes the president of Ukraine.
I want to compare that situation to situation where, for example, you come into the plane, you boarding, and you taking your seat, and now you see the man who look like a pilot, who dressed like a pilot, who speak like a pilot, greeting passengers, but who is not a pilot at all, who is an actor, who played a pilot, in response for your life.
We had a meeting at the MI6 office. Unfortunately, I can't disclose all the information. It's a matter of state affairs.
Autumn 2020. Ukrainian media accidentally, or maybe not, learned about Zelensky's secret meeting with Richard Moore, the head of MI6. Not just anywhere, but at the headquarters of British Intelligence Service. According to the president, the meeting was about protecting Ukraine's sovereignty.
Yes, the meeting of Volodymyr Zelensky is something new, because if we look at World War II, the Cold War, we have never had real meetings between the leader of a country in a state of war and a group of intelligence representatives.
As a Secret Service agent, I'd like to tell you that there are special norms of decency and protocol. When a president of a sovereign country is on a foreign territory, he should meet with his counterpart. The only exception is if the head of intelligence himself comes to Ukraine to meet with Zelensky.
Coming down to the lowest level, to the head of the intelligence agency, is not a simple admission of guilt. At that time, the person becomes an actual professional agent. It is clear. One handler always works with one agent. In the case of Zelensky, the head of MI6, Richard Moore, became his direct handler.
Trust my experience. You can't just make someone work as an agent without a hook or substantial grounds. And if we carefully trace the events leading up to this remarkable meeting, we will find them. In the summer of 2020, British intelligence almost captured the internationally renowned Wagner PMC members. These Wagnerians took Bakhmut, for example, Palmyra in Syria. They significantly interfered in spreading British policy in Africa. It happened that the mercenaries slipped right under the nose of MI6. Whether it's true or not, they say the operation failed due to the office of the President of Ukraine. Somebody called and warned them. Now, no one will figure out if it was a mistake, a calculation, or foolishness. That's why Richard Moore didn't bother investigating. They summoned Zelensky to show him his place and at the same time to discuss the extent of his independence and freedom in Ukraine.
They expect proposals about independent media from us. They are ready to finance them together with Ukraine to provide Ukraine with information that corresponds to the main issue. Protection of freedom and human rights, and above all, shield the information that defends our country.
Everyone understands. The MI6 office gave the president of Ukraine a precise directive. The thing is, after the Maidan in 2014, there are quite a lot of Ukrainian opposition media. Obviously, they were preventing the creation of an image of Russia as an enemy to Western countries. It was decided to end the dissenters with Zelensky's hands. And to prevent the president from getting bored and to help him practice English, He was surrounded by British security. This was in the spring of 2022, in the midst of war in Bucha. Look at these scenes. Do you see a patch on the sleeve of one of the guys near Zelensky? The Ukrainian flag is upside down. A local would have been shot on the spot for this. But this guy is okay. Do you know why? Because he has the right to. He is a foreigner, like everyone else around Zelensky. In fact, judging by the pronunciation, they're British.
As we can see, Zelensky's security team consists of Brits. Quite marvelous, because we have the so-called Ninth Administration, the President's Security, with 1,800 professional military guys, special forces, and combat swimmers.
Well, not surprising. Firstly, UK intelligence services most likely helped Zelensky with the theatrical staging in Bucha. Secondly, the British follow every step of their agent, even during the meeting with the Pope. Oh, this episode deserves special attention. It seemed to me like a meeting between a priest and a devil. Judge for yourselves. Zelensky went to the Vatican in a black sweatshirt with the emblem of the UNO, Ukrainian Nationalist Organization. He gave the Pope an icon with a black silhouette instead of Christ, which is outright Satanism, according to church canons. He plopped into a chair before the host. For those unaware, this is a gross violation of etiquette. And he didn't pay much attention to Pope Francis's peaceful initiatives. Italians considered that rude. I'm sure this whole comedy was a distraction. The central communication of Zelensky took place not in the Pope's office, but in the next room, without the involvement of Pope Francis, but with the participation of the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Holy See, Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher, a native Brit whose cardinals are conducting powerful propaganda in Ukraine. The Ukrainian president spoke with Gallagher for almost an hour and a half. But the main detail is that the head of MI6, Richard Moore, was also present at the meeting in the Vatican. Maybe this fact explains the record-breaking motorcade of the leader of independent Ukraine, over 20 cars.
To be sure that that guy did not make a trick to make it suddenly make a peace with Vladimir Putin, they take hostages, his kids and a wife, in a Great Britain. This is another layer of security for masters of puppets.
Yeah, so that's a clip from Agent Zelensky by Scott Ritter. That's from the first part, but there's now another part out too, and I'll be uploading that tonight on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, all being well. And you can watch them out there on all various platforms like YouTube. Now, all sorts of interesting stuff coming out there, Martin. It sounds as if and looks as if you watch the actual film, I don't know if you've seen it, that Zelensky is absolutely surrounded by British security, by this guy, Richard Moore, the head of MI6. And what Scott Ritter's saying there is unequivocally is that Moore is the officer and Zelensky is the agent that he's running.
Well, I think that's absolutely legitimate comment by Scott Ritter, isn't it? I think the British have played a particularly vicious role in this whole crisis. They have basically been very much involved in a lot. I mean, I think they were involved, for example, in the Kerch Bridge bombing that we just discussed earlier. They were involved in the first attack, which was basically, you know, got to be classified as a terrorist attack. The guy driving the truck didn't even know how to bomb in the back. That was British. The assassination of Zakhachenko in 2017 in the Donbass, he was the elected Prime Minister of the Donbass, and he was killed by a bomb attack in his office. This is at a time when there's supposedly a ceasefire, and we're supposedly negotiating around Minsk too. But the British have been involved in sabotaging all of this all the way.
What is your evidence that the British were even involved in either of those two attacks?
Well, the evidence for both of those things is that if you look at Kit Klarenberg's stuff on the Grey Zone, there's evidence come out that the British were involved in all of these things. I'm just going on instinct, but in actual fact, there is evidence out there. And don't forget, the British government never takes any occasion not to go on about how strongly they support Kiev and all the rest of it. We know, because this is factual, that there are at least scores of SAS guys in the Ukraine. We know. And the Russians know very well that in actual fact the Ukrainian army is being led by NATO, which will include British officers. Givi and Motorola, who were paramilitary leaders in the Donbass, they were also assassinated. And of course, what may start happening to British generals is that they might start getting assassinated and having accidents as well, because obviously that's fair game, isn't it? Oh, and prime ministers, Rishi.
Wasn't it quite interesting, the Wagner scenario, where apparently Zelensky tipped them off that the British were after them, and then Zelensky is hauled into London and told, basically, look, either you better behave yourself or else. And also, of course, the British being there when he went to meet the Pope. So there is certainly some evidence, it seems, that the Brits are far more involved with this at the intelligence level and the controlling the government of Ukraine, you know, the sovereign government of Ukraine, than we're led to believe.
Absolutely. And, you know, we are definitely number one on the Russian hit list. They don't like the Americans. They're fed up with everybody in the West, really. But we are definitely got it. Not me and you, Tony. Our government and our intelligence services and our military are regarded as bad actors. And ultimately, of course, there could be a price to pay for that. Because if this escalates, it's not going to escalate necessarily in the Ukraine. The obvious weak link to hit from the Russian point of view is Britain. So as I mentioned earlier, we've got two very nice bridges near here. Two very nice bridges. Not as big as the Kerch Bridge. Not as posh as the Kerch Bridge, but definitely attackable. And what would we do if somebody did attack them? What else could we do to the Russians that we haven't already done?
That is exactly the sort of thing I think that NATO would love, because
that's why the Russians won't do it.
To embroil a NATO country in a war with Russia is not necessarily going to have a great prospect.
No, I know, but at some point we may reach the point where the Russian patience will run out. If the Russians had a less rational leadership than they've got, then their patience may already have run out.
I think we need to chart what's been going on, because this week the Russians have put all of the British, and I think, isn't it American, Western diplomats, NATO diplomats, on the special list. That is to say that only the ambassadors are allowed to travel around without having to notify. So any other official from the embassy other than the ambassador in Moscow from the NATO countries now has to say where they intend to go, and give the Russians prior notice of any movements that they make around the country.
Well, we know that NATO intelligence services, and it's supposedly a non-US country, are organising what you might call stay-behind networks inside Russia, which is why you had this drone attacks on the Kremlin. Those drones were fired from nearby. So what the British have been doing over many years, and Richard Moore was talking about, we want to recruit more Russians, and they're also recruiting Russian nationalists, for example, to invade Belgrade. They are looking for those who are prepared to carry out, insurgency inside Russia against the government. Russians are very well aware of all of this, obviously.
It's unprecedented, as far as I know, that the British are advertising for Russians that don't like Putin so that they can join the war against him by Zelensky.
Yeah, in a sense, it suggests how desperate they are. They're just saying, anybody, come and join us, because you'd have thought, if they're any good, they'd have recruited people and we wouldn't even know about it. But there you are.
Is that this is the benefit, I suppose, of email, if you can call it a benefit, that these people might email MI6 and find that they can then be part of some sort of underground network in Russia attacking the government.
Yes, and it might well be, as we were talking about encryption earlier, that the FSB will capture that email and then they're going to go to prison. These things are going on. I mean, the Russians are getting fed up with this, because we are actually... I mean, do you remember the assassination of that journalist in the cafe in St. Petersburg? We are engaging in what, when the IRA used to do it, we used to call terrorism. But when we do it, it's just called special operations.
So one of the big things that's happened this week is the announcement of Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, that he's standing down. Now, he's, one wouldn't say a terrific chap, but he does tend to speak his mind. And as we reported last week, he spoke his mind at the NATO conference, very much stepping out of line by having a go at Zelensky, taking the mickey out of him, saying that Zelensky was that Britain was not Amazon, where Zelensky could just order the weapons from, you know. Don't go online and order them from Britain, which was, I thought, rather a nice little put down. And of course, by doing that, he's broken the great religion of anti-Russia-dom and pro-Zelensky-dom there is in NATO. Anyway, he announced the next day or a couple of days later that he won't be standing. Of course, he was in the running, wasn't he, to be NATO Secretary General. So well done, Ben Wallace, for speaking out, and well done for not doing what the NATO Secretary General, the Americans, etc., want you to do. And so when he does stand down, I was just looking through the most obvious person to take over from him is Tom Tugendhat. So we'll hear your view, Martin, after we hear a clip from Tom Tugendhat. He is, I think, security minister now. So he's the minister for MI5 and MI6 and GCHQ and various other things, special branch as well, probably all the super secret stuff. And he's a kind of funny bloke. He's, you know, you look at him and you think, God, there's nothing much to him, but he's in charge of all this stuff, supposedly. Maybe he's just the sort of person who will do exactly as he's told and doesn't think for himself. And maybe that's the perfect role that these services wish to have in that role. But anyway, so Tom Tugendhat, as a PM hopeful last year, he actually stood to be Prime Minister when Boris Johnson was forced out. Let's go back to last year to have a listen to him on Sky, who was blasting the disgraceful stories against the Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi's tax affairs at the time, because the tax affairs of Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi, as I'm sure all our diligent listeners know, did end up hanging him. In other words, booting him out from being chairman of the Tory party. So here we have Tom Tugendhat calling it totally wrong, I'm sure you're glad to hear, about whether or not Nadeem Zahawi last year was a decent guy or not.
The two people that were knocked out today, Jeremy Hunt, whose campaign never really seemed to get much momentum, and Nadeem Zahawi, who had quite a lot of promise, many thought, at the start of this campaign, but seems to have had a lot of negative briefing around him, accusations around his tax affairs. What do you make of the way this race is being conducted?
Well, look, I think the way that people have treated Nadeem Zahawi is utterly disgraceful, because the briefing against him has been completely unacceptable. What we need to do is we need to have a clean campaign. What we are doing here is we are running a democratic campaign in order to allow the membership of our party to choose from the two members of parliament who actually enjoy the support of most of their colleagues. Now, that's a really important thing to do. It's massively important, because whoever wins is going to be the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and lead us into the next general election.
Hank, you're making a serious charge here. You say that there's been disgraceful briefing against Nadeem Zahawi. What are you talking about, and who's behind it?
Well, I can't tell you who's behind it. All I can say is that these stories have appeared seemingly from nowhere at a very, very brief moment, and with very poor sourcing.
Well, of course, the sourcing wasn't poor at all. It was all 100% correct. And it did turn out that Nadeem Zahawi, whilst he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, was running to be... when he was running to be Prime Minister, this time last year-ish, then it turned out that actually he hadn't been paying his own tax whilst he was Chancellor. So, and also, of course, Martin, interesting Tugendhat running into defend Zahawi, who was, I'm not sure if he still is, chairman of the Pinay Circle, which is this ex-intelligence, super far-right fascist organisation started by one of the people who was in charge in Vichy France during World War II. So, I mean, this is obviously a far-right NATO faction here that Tugendhat is trying to defend what turned out to be the indefensible. So he's a kind of cliquist who's trying very hard to crawl up the backside of Nadeem Zahawi there.
Well, Tugendhat is ex-military, and he's very close to the intelligence services. He's not particularly liked in the mainstream of the Tory parliamentary party, because he's seen as a bit of a moderate from their point of view, but he's very much part of the deep state. Ben Wallace didn't get the job, I understand, for being NATO Secretary General, because the Americans are actually getting a bit cold feetish about what's going on in the Ukraine, and they don't want a blowhard Brit like Ben Wallace in charge of it, and that's why Stoltenberg's staying on. Ben Wallace was the Russian pranksters got through to him when he was in Poland, and they had a Skype conversation with him, and he came straight out with, you know, because he thought he was talking to Zelensky's people, and he was saying, well, we've got to keep the Germans and the French out of this because they, you know, they want some kind of peace with Russia. So we the British and you, the Ukrainians and the Americans, we've got to frustrate any attempt by the Germans and the French to make peace here. So he came straight out with that. He thought he was not being, he thought he was talking to Zelensky's people. He was actually talking to two Russian pranksters who put it up on the internet, obviously.
Ben Wallace is on the way out. What about Security Minister Tom Tugendhat? And here he is on Sky, a much more recent story. Last week, in fact, he talks here about the National Security Act, and he defends Ben Wallace, Ben Wallace saying those things to the Zelensky last week. Tugendhat is obviously trying to ingratiate himself to Ben Wallace as well before he fills his boots.
It's one of the things that's very encouraging. When I was in Ukraine in August, and indeed a few months before that, one of the things that really struck me was how pro-British, how very grateful Ukrainians are and have been to the UK. It's been something that's really touched me, but you know, I'm also very grateful to the Ukrainians. They are genuinely defending European freedom in the struggle that they're conducting at the moment against Russian aggression.
Is there a worry then that people are getting Ukraine fatigue?
No, I don't think there is. I mean, look, I travel around the United Kingdom a lot, and
elsewhere as well, in the US, for example, you know, we can see what's playing out with the upcoming presidential election. Is there a worry that actually some politicians, some members of the public indeed, might be looking at the amount of money, the amount of weapons going there and thinking, oh, how long is this going to go on for?
Sophie, I think it's reasonable for politicians, representatives of their communities to ask how much money is being spent and is it being spent appropriately. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing for people to ask. What's quite striking is all the way across the United Kingdom, you see Ukrainian flags everywhere. I mean, you see them on public buildings, you see them on private buildings, you see them in shops, you see them on supermarkets, you see them all over the place. You know, the level of support for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people here is enormous. And when you look at when we opened the doors to Ukrainians to come and seek shelter in the UK, the number of people, I mean, I'm always deeply touched by the generosity of the British public. And how many people opened their homes, quite literally opened their homes, to Ukrainians who needed somewhere to shelter as this war against them was being conducted by this evil Russian regime.
A couple of other questions while I've got you. You've been looking at the threats to the UK, in particular on the sort of cyber security side. How concerned are you about China in particular in this space?
Well, look, we've seen, I'm afraid to say, hostile activity by states against the UK growing in recent years. We've seen it getting worse, and we've seen cyber attacks, as you mentioned. We've seen from Iran, we've seen attempted assassinations, as Ken McCullen, the head of MI5, reported only a few months ago. We've seen disinformation. We've seen a whole series of different ways in which hostile states are trying to do harm to the United Kingdom and harm the British people and our freedoms. And that's why, you know, this government has reacted so clearly, because the first duty of any government is to protect the British people, and that's exactly what we've done. So we've introduced, as you know, the National Security Act, which is a fantastically important piece of legislation. It does, fundamentally, it does two things. The first is it makes sure that we're a harder target. It deters aggression, and it disrupts aggressors in their actions. And the second thing it does is it gives powers to our intelligence services to pursue those who either are trying to do harm to us or are siding with those who try to do harm with us. And I think that's incredibly important, a very important response to some of the aggressions that we've heard about.
That's Tom Tugendhat there speaking on Sky. My money's on him, Martin. Also, he seems to be hinting there with his wonderful, glorious National Security Act, he's coming for people like us.
Well, he's definitely, as I said before, he's a definite deep state insider. There's no doubt about that. I understand Ben Wallace is going to stay on until there is a reshuffle. Then he's going to go to the back benches and he's not going to come back to Parliament. He's not going to stand again. So he'll carry on until there's a reshuffle. There's a possibility of a reshuffle because of what happened in the by-elections yesterday, but I don't think it's going to happen soon.
There's quite a few Tories doing this, aren't there? Dominic Raab, Boris Johnson, saying, right, we've had enough, we're out. I mean, Boris obviously went a little bit early, but quite a few of them are saying, I'll stand and finish as an MP. But they're creating this sort of faction of annoyed Tories MPs. So I wonder if anything's... Anyway, look, my money's definitely on Tugendhat. Any other runners do you think you might put your money on?
I think you're quite likely that he might be in the running. But there is no vacancy until Rishi Sunak reshuffles. We thought he might reshuffle today after the by-elections yesterday, but he hasn't done so, and he's flagging up that he's not going to until the autumn. So there won't be any vacancy until he does.
Yeah, well, you know, so there's a lot of juggling going on, particularly over this war. Is anyone else you'd like to think? I mean, my money's definitely on him, and you saying he's in the running. Of course, he's in the running. I'm going to put my money on the nose. That is to say, him coming in first. Anyone else? Do you think?
Well, I think that's a reasonable guess, but don't forget, Ben Wallace is still in place until Rishi Sunak has got the bottle for a reshuffle. He hasn't got the bottle for a reshuffle, because the danger with a reshuffle is that he just shows weakness after what happened yesterday in the by-elections.
I mean, basically, Rishi has got to get all his ducks in a line, hasn't he, which isn't an easy thing to do when you're a puppet. Anyway, so we've got the next clip. Is I think we'll have a listen to, since we're talking about security in Tugendhat, I mean, it's really worrying to think that this moron could become Defence Secretary. I actually prefer Ben Wallace. At least he's fairly straight talking, even if he's on the wrong side with Ukraine. At least he's prepared to also call out Zelensky from time to time. He's got the guts to do that, which Tugendhat definitely doesn't have. Let's have a listen now to James Bamford, because I was going to play this last week with Kevin. I would have loved to have got Kevin's ideas, because James, I think, has done a brilliant job over the years. I think he was one of the first people to ever write an entire book who'd worked at the National Security Agency in the United States. And his latest book is called Spy Fail. I mean, he's interestingly, Martin, what he's basically saying here is that the real big failure in intelligence, which nobody's talking about, is counterintelligence. So what do you make of that basic assertion before we hear from James Bamford?
Well, unless, you know, counterintelligence just means that all organisations have to, you know, especially secret ones, have to prevent themselves being infiltrated, and they have to catch the moles. So, I mean, yes, they've got to be good at it, and if they're rubbish at it, they lose. But that's all there is to say, really, isn't it?
Well, there is
more to say, but you've got to talk about specifics.
You know, for many people that don't necessarily understand this, the job of counterintelligence is to stop foreign actors doing political operations or military operations within your country.
It's so within your own intelligence services.
This is MI5's job, basically. And also, of course, to stop any kind of interference in elections. But what James Bamford, I think, is quite rightly pointing out is that the really, really big failure is in this area. Of course, you know, Martin and I, we've looked into the 7/7 bombings, and we find that MI5 were actually complicit in those bombings, complicit in protecting people like Haroon Aswat, who was directly involved in the 7/7 London bombing. So when there were attempts to get him arrested by other Muslims at the Finsbury Park Mosque, MI5 protected him rather than arrested him. We see time and again with all the 2017, the big three terror attacks that happened before the Jeremy Corbyn 2017 election, where in the week before the election itself, Jeremy Corbyn himself, after these three terrorist attacks, was talked about as a terrorist. He's meeting with terrorists. So this was obviously a ploy to make everyone think that Corbyn, if he was going to be prime minister, was going to be a terrorist prime minister. So all those people involved in those previous, it's the Manchester Arena attack, we had the London Bridge attack, we had the Westminster Bridge attack, every single one of the leaders, as it turns out, apparently, of those attacks were phoned in by people that knew them to the MI5 terrorist anti-terrorist hotline, and the MI5 did absolutely nothing about it. So I think James Bamford's focus on the failures of counterintelligence, whether that's the FBI in the United States or MI5 in London, is absolutely brilliant. So well done. And another brilliant book. His book is called Spy Fail, and here then is James Bamford talking about his book. And also he talks here about the Israelis and the involvement of Arlan Milchan, who's a Hollywood film producer, as an Israeli nuclear spy.
He basically admits to being an arms dealer for apartheid South Africa and all these other things. And then they get into his espionage, and he basically admits it. De Niro is sitting next to him, and De Niro says, oh yeah, he told me about that. I asked him about that years ago, and he was involved with these little things. And then Milchan says, Krytons. And then De Niro says, yeah, Krytons. And he says, yeah, I did it for my country. and all that. And Milchin doesn't deny it or anything, sitting there. And then afterwards, the interview, the woman who did the interview expressed her surprise that Milchin, you know, finally basically admitted that he had done these things. So the problem was he thought that nobody was going to see that in the U.S., but he flew back to the United States, and apparently somebody at the State Department, somewhere in the bowels of the State Department, had caught wind of it or saw it. And Milchin had been living in the United States for a lot of his adult life as a big Hollywood producer. And he would live here on a 10-year visa, and every 10 years he'd get the visa renewed. Well, after he did that interview, somebody at the State Department canceled his 10-year visa. And Milchin became panicky, not only because, you know, this is where he'd been living all his life and this is where he made his money as a Hollywood producer, but if they cancel his visa, you know, maybe the FBI is after him now. So he got very nervous, and he called up Netanyahu, who was one of his old friends, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, and said, "You got to help me. You got to help me get my visa back, my 10-year visa." And so Netanyahu went to the U.S. ambassador in Israel and got him to agree. But all he could do is do 1 year. In order to get 10 years, he needed to get that directly from the Secretary of State, John Kerry. So Milchin then gets Netanyahu. Netanyahu agrees to put a meeting together between Milchin and Kerry, and eventually Milchin gets his 10-year visa back. I guess that's what it appeared to be. So after that, Milchin's happy; he's got his visa back. But Netanyahu doesn't think this is all over at this point. He wants a little payoff, so he starts asking for these, basically what they are, bribes, and so Milchin then starts giving him all these expensive gifts and bribes, and it turns out to be several hundred thousand dollars worth of these bottles of pink, cases of pink champagne, expensive cigars, $40,000 bracelets for his wife, and all these things. And for years, Milchin thought that the FBI would never come after him in the U.S. because they just don't go after people from Israel. Israel spies have a sort of a free card, get out of jail free card in the U.S., at least Israeli spies from Israel, not people like Pollard who happen to be Americans, but Israeli spies. So he didn't think that there'd ever be a knock on his door from the FBI, which there wasn't. But then he goes back to Israel, and all of a sudden, the Israelis are after him, and the Israeli police are after him, and the Israeli police are after Netanyahu because they heard of this, these bribes taking place. So unlike the U.S., the Israeli police didn't have any problems going after either the prime minister or Milchin. So they either threatened, well, at one point they threatened Milchin that he was going to be under arrest, and he agreed so in return to have that dropped, he agreed to be a state's witness for the prosecution against Netanyahu. And all these riots and everything that's taking place in Israel today largely have their origins with this, because what happened was Netanyahu was brought to court on these three serious charges, and he lost office. He was defeated in the election. And so he was out of office for about a year, but the trial is still going on. And then he wins re-election, and the trial is still going on. So he's still facing these charges. He may end up in jail. And one of the most serious charges is the one involving Milchin. So he's facing these charges. He's now prime minister. And so what he's trying to do is rework the justice system so that basically the government will have the ability to overrule judges and so forth, especially the Supreme Court judges. And he's looking at it as that's a way for he won't have to go to trial. He won't have to go to jail. They'll cancel the if he's able to accomplish this, they'll cancel the trial. And so, but that basically means involves getting rid of a lot of the judicial system and the independence of the Supreme Court. And that's why there's been all these riots in Israel now. They don't seem to care about the Palestinians, but they certainly want a democratic government for themselves. So they've been rioting in Israel over Netanyahu's changes to the judiciary. So again, following this thread all the way through from Netanyahu in the mid-60s all the way to the riots taking place today in Israel, it's been really a fascinating journey. And really, I'm the only person that really puts that whole framework together.
Well, thank you very much, James Bamford. His original book was The Puzzle Palace. He doesn't let us down. That's a mind-blowing little journey, isn't it, Martin, from Robert De Niro sitting down with Arlen Milchan in Hollywood and chit-chatting about how the conversation began to do with getting the nuclear secrets over to Israel, to Dimona. And then he does a little dodgy deal with Netanyahu to get him his visa. And then all of a sudden, the bribes end up in Netanyahu up in court. And you know what? It's incredible how for these characters trying to manipulate world affairs, Milchan and Netanyahu, actually, they're much safer in the United States than they are in their own country. As soon as they come back to Israel, Arlen Milchan is suddenly embroiled in this case against Netanyahu, which has led to some of the protests that we've been seeing all through the year, including at the Ben-Gurion airport and various other things amongst the Israeli population.
Well, I think it is interesting, is it not, that the Israeli police are prepared to go after him, but the US police do not dare, although obviously some efforts were taken against him, which is why he lost his visa. It's not really a secret, is it, that Mossad are very deeply involved in what goes on in this country and in the US. They're definitely here. They're definitely steering things as far as they can see from behind the scenes. As you know, in our investigation into 7/7, we know that Netanyahu had a warning about the bomb the morning of the attack, because that's what the embassy told the Jerusalem Times of Israel, or was it the Jerusalem Post? Now, that implies that the Israelis, having forewarning of the attack, were probably involved in the attack. So they were probably involved in 7/7 and probably our own intelligence services as well. But our world is, you know, you and I know about these things, but I tell you what, most people have totally, they've been watching Wimbledon. That's what they've been doing. They don't really pay attention.
Well, I think that's fine if people want to watch Wimbledon.
There's nothing wrong with Wimbledon, but it's not the whole world. Horses, and there's all sorts of things going on that people need to know about, but they don't.
As we were hearing about from Louise Crefield, the lovely, am I allowed to say that, Louise Crefield from Save Our Rights last week, people are actually far too busy, and that's deliberate. The idea is that you don't have time to think about politics, world affairs, and how potentially a few criminals, or rather a large gang of criminals, are shafting you, do you?
No, you don't. And of course, the psychological warfare masters of all of this. I mean, you've had Turgenhat earlier going on about how the Ukrainian flags were everywhere. And you feel like saying to those people, what do you know about the Ukraine? And the answer is not very much. They've been told what to think about it, and they think what they've been told to think. But if you start asking basic questions about the recent history of Ukraine, it's quite obvious they don't know. They just don't know about it. And that's a problem. And that's why RT's been taken off the air. It only had a limited audience. But, of course, these kind of things, like the massacre in the Maidan Square and who really did it, the Americans, because we've had a court case in Kiev. And that should have been all over the Western media, but it wasn't. And therefore, people get very, very limited view, especially places like Ukraine where they didn't know anything about it before. I mean, Israel, Palestine, they're pretty much aware of what that's about. But Ukraine, they don't really understand that. They don't know how Ukraine was created in 91 and all the rest of it.
Martin, I don't agree with you at all. I think many people across the country have deep worries about this. But what we're getting is these repeated... It's an attempt to tell the big lie again and again and again and again. And I think many, many people out there recognise it, particularly our generation. And also the younger people, of course, have got much more access to social media. So they're not necessarily getting their news on the news at 10 from the BBC. So One of the people who should be getting far more, I think you might even agree with this, Martin, attention on our London media, particularly the TV channels, BBC, ITV, etc., is the guy that's running for the Democratic nomination for US President, Robert Kennedy Jr. And he was on Piers Morgan this week. I got home, I think it was this time last week, roughly, quite surprised to see him on Talk TV with an interview by Piers Morgan. And so let's have a listen to there. This is a clip from that longer interview where Piers Morgan talks to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. About this term anti-vaxxer, which is used to describe him.
I did not spend my lifetime of thinking about someday I'm going to run for president. A bunch of things happened, particularly since COVID. Over the last 18 years, I've been subject to a lot of censorship on the issue of vaccines. So most people think, you know, call me anti-vaccine, but I'm not anti-vaccine. But I'm called that in order to silence me. And I've been silenced in, you know, many, many ways for the last 18 years, but particularly since COVID. When there was blanket censorship around the country and in the UK and everywhere, people, you know, doctors who were reporting injuries in their patients from the vaccines or reporting success from early treatments like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine were all silenced because that was not part of the political narrative. And the frustration, that censorship. And now, you know, there was a case that a 155-page opinion that was issued earlier this week by a judge in Missouri about enjoining the White House from censoring people anymore. And it's a large part of that decision is about the censorship of me by the Biden White House. I was the first person censored. So Biden came into office on January 21st, 2021, and on January 23rd, Twitter and the other social media sites refused or received orders from the White House to deplatform me, and then
certainly think that a lot of the censorship that went on during COVID on many fronts was completely wrong, looking back over it, and shouldn't have been happening. Let me just ask you, have you ever had a vaccine or anything?
Have I had vaccines? Yeah. I was fully compliant.
What have you had in your life? I mean, vaccines. What?
Well, I had all the vaccines. You know, when I was a kid, I took the three vaccines that were then required. Now, my kids' generation, there are 72 vaccines required in this country, 72 doses of 16 vaccines. But I was traveling a lot as a kid. I went to Africa, Latin America, and everything. So I received that entire battery that you used to receive. So I probably received more vaccines than most people in my generation.
And your kids, have all had vaccines?
My kids were all fully vaccinated now.
So you're not intrinsically anti-vaccine?
No, I was never anti-vaccine. All I want is the safety science. I think that we should have placebo-controlled trials, which are required for every other medical product, prior to licensing vaccines. And unfortunately, vaccines are exempt from those. They're the only medicine or medical product that are exempt from pre-licensing safety trials. And, you know, and therefore, we do not know what the risk profile for any of these products are. And we do not know for any particular of those 72 doses whether they are averting more problems than they're causing. And I just think we ought to know that. I also don't believe that we should have mandates.
Well, it's a much longer interview with Piers Morgan on Talk TV, but excellent to see. Martin, do you think he stands much of a chance of getting the Democratic nomination and seeing him in the White House?
Well, not if the deep state have got any power, and they have. He's got an uphill struggle there. I wish him well, but it's very difficult. He's got to get the Democratic nomination. And Biden obviously is not going to easily give that up. And don't forget that the system of choosing the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party is pretty much stitched up, because they have all these super delegates which are appointed by the party machine, which can overwhelm any grassroots insurgency.
Martin, as we heard last week, Biden doesn't know where he is.
That's you asked me, first of all, whether Robert F. Kennedy had got any chance of winning the nomination and becoming president. Biden is another issue. Of course, there's loads of issues with Biden, but he is, as we speak, the president, and Robert F. Kennedy isn't, and I suspect he won't be, because he's got such an uphill struggle. It's going to be very difficult for him to get the nomination because of what nearly happened with Bernie Sanders. They've definitely stitched it up to make sure that people like him cannot win, just as, well, you know, the removal of Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party means that he can't win, can he?
I think he is in with a chance.
I'm not saying he's not in with a chance. I'm just saying it's an uphill struggle.
But I think he's definitely in with a chance. I like to see people who have got the courage to do what Robert Kennedy Jr. has done here, to stand against the deep state. And even if he is bumped off, I'm sure he's quite well aware that he may have the same fate as his uncle and his father, that the deep state will just simply say, well, we're not going to allow this person anywhere near to stand. We're fed up with having all the shenanigans about fixing elections. It's too boring. Let's just bump him off. And that may happen. And I'm sure he's quite well aware of that. But it's interesting, isn't it, to hear him talk about, you know, the multiple vaccines he himself has had and that his children have been having over the years, despite him having lots of criticisms of the COVID vaccine and other vaccines and generally wanting to have a better regime, you know. He has actually had the vaccines himself. Fascinating to hear. Anyway, look, Martin, time to say goodbye to you now, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's okay.
Because we've already had this little discussion earlier about whether Robert Kennedy, because we're going to be hearing from him again now, and this is as part of a separate, he's doing quite a lot of interviews, separate interview, obviously in the running for president and being blocked by the mainstream press in the United States and the UK. And probably but most of the rest of the other parts of the world, in fact, they're just trying to, you know, pretend he doesn't exist. We're going to hear now from his discussion about who is God. And he's asked this by an interviewer, but he has, I think, a quite fascinating answer, because obviously he's from a very Catholic family. The Kennedy family, although they were involved in breaking and running, made a lot of money out of the illegal activity during Prohibition. They then have sort of decided to really, really nail their colours to God's church, and they were Catholics who were very rigorous. And anyway, so anyway, it's Lex Fridman, F-R-I-D Fridman, who Robert Kennedy's talking to here, as he explains who he thinks God is.
I mean, God is incomprehensible. You know, I mean, I guess the most philosophers would say we're inside the mind of God. And so it would be impossible for us to understand, you know, what God's form is. But I mean, for me, I have let's say this. I was raised in a very, very deeply religious setting. So we went to church in the summer, oftentimes twice a day. Morning mass, and we definitely went every Sunday, and we prayed in the morning, we prayed before and after every meal, we prayed at night, we said a rosary, sometimes three rosaries a night, and my father read us the Bible, whenever he was home, he would read us, you know, we'd all get in the bed and he'd read us the Bible stories. I went to Catholic schools. I went to Jesuit schools. I went to the nuns. And I went to a Quaker school at one point. When I became a drug addict when I was about 15 years old, about a year after my dad died, and I was addicted to drugs for 14 years. During that time, when you're an addict, you're living against conscience. And when you're living against, I never, you know, I was always trying to get off of drugs, never able to, but I never felt good about what I was doing. And when you're living against conscience, you kind of push God to the peripheries of your life. I'll call me he. Recedes and gets smaller. And then when I got sober, I knew that I had a couple of experiences. One is that I had a friend of my brother's, one of my brothers who died of this disease of addiction, had a good friend who had used to take drugs with us. And he became a Mooney. So he became a follower of Reverend Sun Myung Moon. And he, at that point, his compulsion, he had the same kind of compulsion that I had, and yet it was completely removed from him. And so, and he used to come and hang out with us, but he would not want to take drugs, even if I was taking them right in front of him. He was immune to it. He'd become impervious to that impulse. And when I first got sober, I knew that I did not want to be the kind of person who was, you know, waking up every day and white knuckling sobriety and just, you know, trying to resist through willpower. And by the way, I had iron willpower as a kid. I gave up candy for Lent when I was 12 and I didn't eat it again until I was in college. I gave up desserts the next year for Lent, and I didn't ever eat another dessert till I was in college, and I was trying to bulk up for rugby and for sports. So I felt like I could do anything with my willpower, but somehow this particular thing, you know, the addiction, was completely impervious to it. And it was cunning, baffling, incomprehensible. I could not understand why I couldn't just say no and then never do it again, like I did with everything else. So I was living against conscience, and I thought about this guy, and I, you know, reflecting my own prejudices at that time in my life, I said to myself, I didn't want to be like a drug addict who was wanting a drug all the time and just not being able to do it. I wanted to completely realign myself so that I was somebody who got up every day and just didn't want to take drugs, never thought of them. You know, I kissed the wife and children and went to work and was never thought about drugs the whole day. And I knew that people throughout history had done that. You know, I'd read the lives of the saints. I knew St. Augustine had had a very, very dissolute youth and you know, had the spiritual realignment, transformation. I knew the same thing had happened to St. Paul, you know, at Damascus. The same thing had happened to St. Francis. St. Francis also had a dissolute and fun-loving youth and had, you know, had this deep spiritual realignment. And I knew that that happened to people throughout history. And I thought that's what I needed, you know, something like that. I had the example of this friend of mine, and I used to think about him, and I would think, and this again reflects the bias and the, you know, probably the meanness of myself at that time, but I said I'd rather be dead than be a Mooney. But I wish I somehow could distill that power that he got without becoming a religious nuisance. And at that time, I picked up a book by Carl Jung called Synchronicity. And Jung, he was a psychiatrist, he was a contemporary of Freud's. He was Freud was his mentor, and Freud wanted him to be his replacement, but Freud was an avowed atheist. And Jung was a deeply spiritual man. He had these very intense and genuine spiritual experiences from when he was a little boy, from when he was 3 years old, that he remembers. His biography is fascinating about him because he remembers them with such a detail. And he was interesting to me because he was a very faithful scientist, and I considered myself a science-based person from when I was little. And yet he had this spiritual dimension to him, which infused all of his thinking and really, I think, made him, you know, branded his form of recovery or of treatment. And he thought that he had this experience that he describes in this book, where he's sitting up on the third, he ran one of the biggest sanitariums in Europe in Zurich. And he was sitting up on the third floor of this building, and he's talking to a patient who was describing her dream to him. And the fulcrum of that dream was a scarab beetle, which was an insect that is very, very uncommon, if at all, in Northern Europe, but it's a common figure in the iconography of Egypt and the hieroglyphics on the walls of the pyramids, etc. And while he was talking to her, he heard this bing, bing, bing on the window behind him. And he didn't want to turn around to take his attention off her, but finally he does it. He, in exasperation, he turns around, he throws up the window, and a scarab beetle flies in and lands in his hand. And he shows it to the woman, and he says, is this what you were thinking of? Is this what you were dreaming about? And he was struck by that experience, which was similar to other experiences he's had like that. And that's what synchronicity means. It's an incident, a coincidence, you know. And like if you're talking with somebody about somebody that you haven't thought about in 20 years, and that person calls on the phone, that's synchronicity. Oh, and he believed it was a way that God intervened in our lives that broke all the rules of nature that he had set up, the rules of physics, the rules of mathematics, you know, to reach in and sort of tap us on the shoulder and say, I'm here. And so he tried to reproduce that in a clinical setting. And he would put one guy in one room and another guy in another room and have them flip cards and guess what the other guy had flipped. And he believed that if he could beat the laws of chance, laws of mathematics, that he would prove the existence of an unnatural law, a supernatural law. And that was the first step to proving the existence of a God. He never succeeds in doing it. But he says in the book, even though I can't prove using empirical and scientific tools the existence of a God, I can show through anecdotal evidence, having seen thousands of patients come through this institution, that people who believe in God get better faster and that the recovery is more enduring than people who don't. And for me, hearing that was more impactful than if he had claimed that he had proved the existence of God, because I wouldn't have believed that. But I was already at a mindset where I would have done anything I could to improve my chances of never having to take drugs again by even 1%. And if believing in God was going to help me, whether there's a God up there or not, believing in one itself had the power to help me, I was going to do that. So then the question is, how do you start believing in something that you can't see or smell or hear or touch or taste or acquire with your senses? And Jung provides the formula for that. And he says, act as if, you fake it till you make it. And so that's, you know, what I started doing. I just started pretending there was a God watching me all the time, and kind of life was a series of tests, and there was a bunch of moral decisions that I had to make every day. And each one, you know, these were all just little things that I did, but each one now for me had a moral dimension. Like when I, you know, when the alarm goes off, do I lay in bed for an extra 10 minutes with my indolent thoughts, or do I jump right out of bed? Do I make my bed? Most important decision of the day. Do I hang up the towels? You know, do I, when I go into the closet and pull out my blue jeans and a bunch of those wire hangers fall on the ground, do I shut the door and say, I'm too important to do that, that's somebody else's job, or not? And so, do I put the water in the ice tray before I put it in the freezer? Do I put the shopping cart back in the, you know, place that it's supposed to go, in the parking lot of the Safeway? And if I make a whole bunch of those choices right, that I maintain myself in a posture of surrender, which keeps me open to the power of, to my higher power, to my God. And when I do those things right, when I, you know, so much about addiction is about abuse of power, you know, abuse of, all of us have some power, whether it's our, you know, good looks, or whether it's you know, connections or education or family or whatever. And there's always a temptation to use those to fulfill self-will. And the challenge is, how do you use those always to serve instead God's will and, you know, the good of our community? And that, to me, is kind of the struggle. And when I do that, I feel God's power coming through me, and that I can do things. I'm much more effective as a human being. That gnawing, you know, anxiety that I lived with for so many years, and my God, that it's gone. And that I can kind of like put down the oars and hoist the sail, and, you know, and the wind takes me, and I can see the evidence of it in my life. And you know, the big thing for, you know, the temptation for me is that when all these good things start happening in my life and the cash and prizes start flowing in, you know, how do I maintain that posture of surrender? How do I stay surrendered then when my inclination is to say to God, thanks, God, I got it from here.
Yeah.
And drive the car off the cliff again. And so, you know, I had a spiritual awakening and my desire for drugs and alcohol was lifted miraculously. And it, to me, it was as much a miracle as if I'd been able to walk on water. Because I had tried everything earnestly, sincerely, and honestly for a decade to try to stop, and I could not do it under my own power. And then all of a sudden, it was lifted effortlessly. And, you know, so I saw that evidence, early evidence of God in my life and of the power. And I see it now, you know, every day of my life.
So this is the crime of the London media, is what they don't tell you and what you don't hear. So that's Robert F. Kennedy Jr., candidate to be for the Democratic nomination for U.S. president, standing against Sleepy Joe. But we're not hearing all that much. Interesting, isn't it, Jung? All my emails, I think, even still to this day, I've got a Carl Jung quote on there. The maintenance of secrets is like a psychic poison. It alienates the possessor from the community. And that's a great little maxim. And it's lovely to hear Robert Kennedy's a bit of a Carl Jung fan, as I am. So, yeah, big stuff we're not hearing, isn't there? And that is the trick. That is the thing with the mass media. You don't know what they're not telling you. And, of course, there is something they're not telling you. So we'll wind up this evening with Naomi Wolf. I've been meaning to play this for a couple of weeks, but she talks in, obviously, a similar kind of mindset to Robert Kennedy there. She's taken a great interest in the plandemic and particularly in the shenanigans around the so-called vaccines, which really are kind of gene therapy and experimental mRNA ones, and the AstraZeneca 2, by the way, all sorts of, I think it's called an adenovirus vaccine. And so let's have a listen to her, because she's had a good old look at the Pfizer documents, which came out a few weeks ago. But she does, I think, an excellent drill down into what they really reveal, as we heard from Dr. David Hughes at Lincoln University, the great crime against humanity. So let's have a listen to final clip from Naomi Wolf now.
How to cripple a country, take out the kids of the leaders, right? Take out the kids of the wealthy, the kids of the elite. Who else got mandated? You know, firefighters got mandated. All the people we need in order to defend ourselves are the ones who got mandated. Pilots got mandated, right? Cripple a society. They went for those populations. And they went for those populations rigidly, right? There's no reason that every university except six, including Hillsdale, had to mandate the kids, except that HHS gave them the money and they said you have to do it, right? Well, this is a captured administration and captured institutions that are allowing the CCP and their allies, the World Economic Forum, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to cripple our country. As Brian put it, the CCP wants our land, they want our natural resources, they don't want our people. So that's what you've got. And later studies like those of Ed Dowd show that disability among 18 to 39-year-olds is off the charts, which is just what you want in what's called an asymmetric warfare, which is the CCP likes to not have a kinetic war, but to kind of degrade and demoralize a population rather than having a hot war with shooting. And that's exactly what's going on. And the last thing I'll say for my evidence is that of the adverse events, I mentioned there are 42,000 of them in the Pfizer documents. 36,000 plus are in the United States. About 8,000 plus are in Western Europe in order of political importance. So Britain, Germany, France, Spain, Greece, Italy, like that. Out of all the rest of the adverse events, 7,000 adverse events, roughly, all the 51 countries around the world, other than Western Europe and North America, where this was deployed, they all of those only account for 7,000. So that's not random, right? That's targeting North America and Western Europe. And the last thing I'll say for my evidence that this is a bioweapon, and this is super, super chilling and creepy, is that it's so easy to target a subject by with this injection by things as simple as temperature or dose. Because lipid nanoparticles are liquid at super cold temperatures. You remember the news out, the news stories about it has to be really chilled, has to be, they have to have special refrigerators. That's true. But lipid nanoparticles coalesce, clot, solidify at room temperature and at body temperature. And what you've seen is the guidance about how to store these has changed constantly. So first it was like, keep it in the freezer. And then it was like, you can leave it out for 2 hours. Then it was like, you can leave it out for 6 hours. So there's constant variation in the directions originating from China about how to store this injection, and temperature alone can cause problems. And the other thing I'll tell you is dose. And this is absolutely horrific. But Pfizer dose of active ingredients is 30 micrograms. Moderna is 100 micrograms, more than three times as much. And someone I love got injured by the Moderna vaccine. Well, in the Pfizer documents, it says that 100 micrograms is so high, they had to drop it internally due to its reactogenicity, Pfizer's words. But they didn't tell everyone who got the Moderna dose that this was too high and they shouldn't take a booster. They just kept going. Do you know what the dosage is for children? They want it to be 100 micrograms. Tiny children. So that is my incredibly dark summary to you of what's in the Pfizer documents. I now want to pivot in just the minute or two I have left to happier thoughts, because I don't want you to leave here, you know, clinically depressed and giving up all hope. There's a lot of hope in truth. And again, that's why I love this community, even though I'm brand new here. Because the most horrible things can be faced if you, you know, embrace this principle of liberty and of truth and community. So Pfizer has announced that they have 430 million doses that have expired because no one wants them. And it's vanishingly small numbers of parents who have given in to the relentless propaganda to vaccinate their children with this mRNA injection. So informed consent makes a difference. And informed consent is the law, which people conveniently forgot in the medical establishment in the last 2.5 years. We have lawyers suing Pfizer. And I do believe, and there are a lot of good bills that are being introduced to strip Pfizer of its impunity from lawsuits. And I thoroughly hope and believe, I believe we're looking at a mass murder situation, a war crimes against humanity. And I believe and hope that all of these evildoers, as, you know, friendly as they look in their little outfits, talking to the cameras, I hope they will all face justice in this lifetime. And the last thing I want to say, and I promise I'll make it fast and I'll take questions, is this has been such a hard journey, you know, for me and for Amy Kelly and for all these volunteers to go on, because we're really looking at this abyss of human evil every single day. It's like looking at Baba Yar, you know, when that was first opened to the world. It's completely hard to believe that such a thing has taken place and is still taking place. But I guess very quickly, I just want to say that this experience has forced me to believe in God more literally than I had before. And I know that sounds paradoxical, but I felt like this evil overtook the world in lockstep, in perfect unison, in a way that I could not explain using my critical thinking, my great education. It didn't act like any history previously, right? It was far less random. And there was something metaphysical about it. You know, and the way people were just lost in delusion, all in one delusion. The media all told one lie. Doctors who were healers one minute were death dealers the next minute. Something absolutely metaphysical about it that went beyond human history. So I do believe I've concluded, I don't have answers, but I've concluded that we're in a time like really a biblical moment where humanity is being asked to choose, basically. And I mean, this is very subjective, but I kind of believe that God is going, okay, this is how bad humans can be if you lose touch with me. You know, it's this bad. So I don't really know the answer to that except to say out loud, which I never used to do, that I believe that. And, you know, and I guess, you know, I read the Bible a lot these days, and I read the Old Testament a lot. And I keep turning to, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. So I believe that. So God willing, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So that's Naomi Wolf, absolutely amazing. And by the way, if you've got any ideas of what Robert F. Kennedy is, it's someone that doesn't really believe in God but acts as if he does, which I think is a quite curious way of doing things, please do let us know on the usual channels. And Naomi Wolf there, though, finishing off tonight's program. Thanks very much, obviously, to... Well, not obviously. It's never obvious. We always have to give our thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and particularly also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko tonight with quite an awkward little line from Devon up to Bristol. Or you can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored, my Telegram channel. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast full-length interviews, I hope. It's a little bit dicey this evening, but we'll do our best. Story links, comment page, and our email addresses, Martin and mine. You can subscribe to my weekly email list, which will probably be going out Monday, I imagine, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My various books are available from www.bilderberg.org, which there seems to be a few problems getting through to it. Again, do let me know, take a screenshot or whatever and email me and contact me by whatever means. If you're having trouble getting through to bilderberg.org, then I can pass that on to my service providers. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and Tavistock in Devon on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. And do feel free to make recordings of the show. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
This is Radio Freedom.
KLF is gonna rock you. KLF is gonna rock you.
Okay, everybody, lie down on the floor and keep calm.